Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
The internet is full of half-truths and all-out lies. We've all seen them, and many people on social media complaining about it. Here's your chance to show and prove. WorldAfropedia.com is a black-owned and operated encyclopedia. There are several thousand articles, but we need help. We can't uncover all the truth ourselves. So please, join us and become a writer, editor, or blogger for WorldAfropedia.com today. Every little bit counts. We owe it to the future generations to put the truth out there. Visit WorldAfropedia.com, the African-centered encyclopedia, a global database of African knowledge for the purpose of bringing about global African wisdom and understanding. WorldAfropedia.com.
Average Negroes possess too little intellect, self-reliance, and self-control to make it possible for them to sustain the burden of any respectable form of civilization without a large measure of external guidance and support. Francis Galton, 1873.
Eugenicists believed that Africans were inferior not just mentally but physically, and that left to themselves, left alone, they would not make it. The problem is, it didn't work. With that failure, the eugenicists moved on to what is known as positive eugenics. In positive eugenics, the eugenicists wanted the white population to reproduce, to have so many children that it overwhelmed the black population. But that didn't work either. Next, they moved on to what they called negative eugenics. They knew that they could not round up all the blacks in the nation and execute them, so they decided to create an environment where they would convince the blacks to severely limit the number of children they were going to have, and thereby commit race suicide.
The problem of the socially fit must be treated not as one of color, but as a problem of the spread of feeble-mindedness. Dr. Charles Davenport, 1913, director of the Eugenics Record Office, Cold Spring Harbor, New York, and co-founder of the American Eugenics Society.
Eugenics realized that they could not promote their agenda simply because they knew it would be viewed as politically incorrect and socially unacceptable. So what they did was use code words that were once successful in slavery, terms such as feeble-minded, unfit, words such as imbecile, immoral, criminal. They tagged those labels upon the targeted community. These words were less inflammatory, so it let society more or less not be totally alarmed of the original intent. But deep down inside, I believe everyone truly knew what segment of society and what people they were actually talking about.
Even a cursory glance at the charts, photographs, and diagrams used to popularize eugenic ideals reveals that the unfit were swarthy, black, and ugly by Anglo-Saxon standards, with flattened noses, wiry hair, and prognathous profiles. Harriet Washington, author, Medical Apartheid.
In the early 20th century, the white elitists who made up the eugenics movement were no longer just philosophers and academics. Now they were industrialists and billionaires, who had come to embrace a worldview that was essentially identical to the eugenics movement. The same individuals and corporations who had once made millions on the backs of slaves were now willing to spend millions to get rid of them. But that didn't mean that these guys were interested in being public crusaders for the eugenics movement. They were certainly willing to be the brains and the money behind it, but they would hire crusaders to do the dirty work. And the primary one they settled upon was a woman named Margaret Sanger. She was the founder of the American Birth Control League and the publisher of its newsletter, The Birth Control Review. On a practical level, the relationship between Sanger and these elitists was basically a marriage of convenience. In order to advance their common agendas, they needed a front man and she needed money. And the whole thing would be held together by this kind of bizarre obsession with race and class. The result was that the American Birth Control League became the driving force behind the American eugenics movement. Eugenics would no longer just be a philosophy. Sanger and others like her were going to put it into practice.
We are paying for and even submitting to the dictates of an ever-increasing, unceasingly spawning class of human beings who never should have been born at all. Margaret Sanger, 1922.
The laws of nature require the obliteration of the unfit, and human life is valuable only when it is of use to the community or race. Madison Grant, 1916, co-founder, American Eugenics Society.
The black man has never been a competitor, but has always been subservient to the white race. And just so long as he remains subservient, his position is secure. And just so soon as he becomes a competitor, his fate is sealed. Dr. Benjamin Hayes, eugenicist, 1905.
Context of white supremacy. Gus T. Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Friday, November 4th, 2016. So I have been told this is our second study session on Lothrop Stoddard's The Rising Tide of Color Against White World Supremacy. The book was published in 1920. We are picking up kind of in the midpoint of chapter two, midway in chapter two. The audio segment that you heard at the beginning, that was from the documentary film Ma'afa 21, which details about 200 years, roughly, of white supremacy, specifically around controlling the reproduction of black children. Details the eugenics movement, Planned Parenthood, Margaret Sanger, going through slavery and how looking at the reproduction of black children changed after the end of the plantation era of enslaving black people in this part of the world. I think you heard a reference to one of the books we've talked about before on this program, Medical Apartheid, from our book study session earlier this year. And even in the segment that you just heard, Madison Grant was referenced. Said last week he wrote the introduction to the book that we're reading right now. He and Lothrop Stoddard like peas in a pod in terms of white supremacist thought from the early 20th century. With that, we will go ahead and get started. You can go back in the archives. Mark Crutcher, the suspected race soldier who made Ma'afa 21, he's a white man. He was on the program back in 2009. But that notwithstanding, we will go ahead and get started. This is our second installment, Lothrop Stoddard, The Rising Tide of Color Against White World Supremacy, audio segment number one.
The scope of Japan's aspirations, together with differences of outlook between various sections of Japanese public opinion as to the rate of progress feasible for Japanese expansion, account for Japan's differing attitudes toward the white powers. Officially, the keystone of Japan's foreign policy since the beginning of the present century has been the alliance with England, first negotiated in 1902 and renewed with extensive modifications in 1911. The 1902 alliance was universally popular in Japan. It was directed specifically against Russia and represented the common apprehensions of both the contracting parties. By 1911, however, the situation had radically altered. Japan's aspirations in the Far East, particularly as regards China, were arousing widespread uneasiness in many quarters, and the English communities in the Far East generally condemned the new alliance as a gross blunder of British diplomacy. In Japan also, there was considerable protest. The official organs, to be sure, stressed the necessity of friendship with the mistress of the seas for an island empire like Japan. But opposition circles pointed to England's practical refusal to be drawn into a war with the United States under any circumstances, which constituted the outstanding feature of the new treaty, and declared that Japan was giving much and receiving nothing in return. The growing divergence between Japanese and English views regarding China increased anti-English feeling, and in 1912, the semi-official Japan magazine asserted roundly, that the general feeling in Japan was that the alliance was a detriment rather than a benefit, going on to forecast a possible alignment with Russia and Germany, and remarking of the latter, quote, "Germany's healthy imperialism and scientific development would have a wholesome effect upon our nation and progress. While the German habit of perseverance and frugality is just what we need, German wealth and industry are gradually creeping upward to that of Great Britain and America, and the efficiency of the German army and navy is a model for the world. Her lease of the territory of Kiachau Bay brings her into contact with us, and her ambition to exploit the coal mines of Shantung lends her a community of interest with us. It is not too much to say that German interests in China are greater than those of any other European power. If the alliance with England should ever be abrogated, we might be glad to shake hands with Germany." End quote. The outbreak of the European War gave Japan a golden opportunity, of which she was not slow to take advantage, to eliminate one of the white powers from the Far East. The German stronghold of Kiachau was promptly reduced, while Germany's possessions in the Pacific Ocean north of the equator, the Caroline, Pelew, Marianne, and Marshall Island groups, were likewise occupied by Japanese forces. Here, Japan stopped and politely declined all proposals to send armies to Europe or Western Asia. Her sphere was the Far East. Her real objectives were the reduction of white influence there and the riveting of her control over China. Japanese comment was perfectly candid on these matters. As the semi-official Japanese Colonel Journal put in the autumn of 1914, quote, "To protect Chinese territory, Japan is ready to fight no matter what nation. Not only will Japan try to erase the ambitions of Russia and Germany, it will also do its best to prevent England and the United States from touching the Chinese cake. The solution of the Chinese problem is of great importance for Japan, and Great Britain has little to do with it." End quote. Equally frank were Japanese warnings to the English ally not to oppose Japan's progress in China. English criticism of the series of ultimatums by which Japan forced reluctant China to do her bidding roused angry admonitions like the following from the Tokyo University in April 1915. Quote, "Hostile English opinion seems to want to oppose Japanese demands in China. The English forget that Japan has, by her alliance, rendered them signal services against Russia in 1905 and in the present war by assuring security in their colonies of the Pacific and the Far East. If Japan allied herself with England, it was with the object of understanding Japanese preponderance in China and against the encroachments of Russia. Today, the English seem to be neglecting their obligations toward Japan by not supporting her cause. Let England beware. Japan will tolerate no wavering. She is quite ready to abandon the Anglo-Japanese alliance and turn to Russia, a power with whom she can agree perfectly regarding Far Eastern interests. In the future, even, she is ready to draw closer to Germany. The English colonies will then be in great peril." End quote. As the imminence of a Russo-Japanese understanding, the journal just quoted proved a true prophet, for a year later, in July 1916, the Japanese and Russian governments signed a diplomatic instrument which amounted practically to an alliance. By this document, Russia recognized Japan's paramountcy over the bulk of China, while Japan recognized Russia's special interests in China's western dependencies, Mongolia and Turkestan. Japan had thus eliminated another of the white powers from the Far East, since Russia renounced those ambitions to dominate China proper which had provoked the War of 1904. Meanwhile, the press campaign against England continued. A typical sample is this editorial from the Tokyo Yamato. Quote, "Great Britain has never wished at heart to become Japan's ally. She did not wish to enter into such intimate relations with us, for she privately regarded us as an upstart nation, radically different from us in blood and religion. It was simply the force of circumstances which compelled her to enter into an alliance with us. It is the height of conceit on our part to think that England really cared for our friendship, for she never did. It was the Russian menace to India and Persia on the one hand, and the German ascendancy on the other, which compelled her to clasp our hands." End quote. At the same time, many good things were being said about Germany. At no time during the war was any real hostility to the Germans apparent in Japan. Germany was, of course, expelled from her Far Eastern footholds in smart, workmanlike fashion, But the fight before Kitschau was conducted without a trace of hatred. The German prisoners were treated as honored captives, and German civilians in Japan suffered no molestation. Japanese writers were very frank in stating that, once Germany resigned herself to exclusion from the Far East and acquiesced in Japanese predominance in China, no reason existed why Japan and Germany should not be good friends. Unofficial diplomatic exchanges certainly took place between the two governments during the war, and no rancor for the past appears to exist on either side today. The year 1917 brought three momentous modifications into the world situation: the entrance of the United States and China into the Great War, and the Russian Revolution. The first two were intensely distasteful to Japan. The transformation of virtually unarmed America into a first-class fighting power reacted portentously upon the Far East, while China's adhesion to the Grand Alliance, bitterly opposed in Tokyo, rescued her from diplomatic isolation and gave her potential friends. The Russian Revolution was also a source of perplexity to Tokyo. In 1916, as we have seen, Japan had arrived at a thorough understanding with the Tsarist regime. The new Russian government was an unknown quantity, acting quite differently from the old. Russia's collapse into Bolshevist anarchy, however, presently opened up new vistas, not merely northern Manchuria, but also the huge expanse of Siberia. An almost empty world of vast potential riches lay temptingly exposed. At once, the powerful imperialist elements in Japanese political life began clamoring for forward action. An opportunity for such action was soon vouchsafed by the Allied determination to send a composite force to Siberia to checkmate the machinations of the Russian Bolshevik, now hostile to the Allies and playing into the hands of Germany. The imperialist party at Tokyo took the bit in its teeth, and in a flagrant disregard of the inter-Allied agreement, poured a great army into Siberia, occupying the whole country as far west as Lake Baikal. This was in the spring of 1918. The Allies, then in their supreme death grapple with the Germans, dared not even protest. But in the autumn, when the battle tide had turned in Europe, Japan was called to account, the United States taking the lead in the matter. A furious debate ensued at Tokyo between the imperialist and moderate parties, the hotter Jingos urging defiance of the United States, even at the risk of war. Then, suddenly, came the news that Germany was cracking, and the moderates had their way. The Japanese armies in Siberia were reduced, albeit they still remained the most powerful military factor in the situation. Germany's sudden collapse and the unexpectedly quick ending of the war was a blow to Japanese hopes and plans in more ways than one. Despite official felicitations, the nation could hardly disguise its chagrin. For Japan, the war had been an unmixed benefit. It had automatically made her mistress of the Far East and had amazingly enriched her economic life. Every succeeding month of hostilities had seen the white world grow weaker and had conversely increased Japanese power. Japan had counted on at least one more year of war. Small wonder that the Japanese passing of this halcyon time provoked disappointment and regret. The above outline of Japanese foreign policy reveals beneath all its surface mutations a fundamental continuity. Whatever may be its ultimate goals, Japanese foreign policy has one minimum objective: Japan as a hegemon of a Far East in which white influence shall have been reduced to a vanishing quantity. That is the bald truth of the matter, and no white man has any reason for getting indignant about it. Granted that Japanese aims endanger white vested interests in the Far East. Granted that this involves rivalry and perhaps war. That is no reason for striking a moral attitude and inveighing against Japanese wickedness, as many people today are doing. These mighty racial tides flow from the most elemental of vital urges: self-expansion and self-preservation. Both outward thrust of expanding life and counter thrust of threatened life are equally normal phenomena. To condemn the former as criminal and the latter as selfish is equally silly or hypocritical, and tends to envenom with unnecessary rancor what objective fairness might keep a candid struggle inevitably yet alleviated by mutual comprehension and respect. This is no mere plea for sportsmanship. It is a very practical matter. There are critical times ahead, times in which intense race pressures will engender high tensions and perhaps wars. If men will keep open minds and will eschew the temptation to regard those opposing their desires to defend or possess, respectively, as impious fiends, the struggles will lose half their bitterness, and the wars, if there must be, will be shorn of half their ferocity. The unexpected ending of the European War was, as we have seen, a blow to Japanese calculations. Nevertheless, the skill of her diplomats at the ensuing Versailles Conference enabled Japan to harvest most of her war gains. Japan's territorial acquisitions in China were definitely written into the peace treaty, despite China's sullen veto, and Japan's preponderance in Chinese affairs was tacitly acknowledged. Japan also took advantage of the occasion to pose as the champion of the colored races by urging the formal promulgation of racial equality as part of the peace settlement, especially as regards immigration. Of course, the Japanese diplomats had no serious expectation of their demands being acceded to. In fact, they might have been rather embarrassed if they had succeeded in view of Japan's own stringent laws against immigration and alien landholding. Nevertheless, it was a politic move, useful for future propagandist purposes, and it advertised Japan broadcast as the standard bearer of the colored cause. The notable progress that Japan has made toward the mastery of the Far East is written plainly upon the map, which strikingly portrays the broadening territorial base of Japanese power effected in the past 25 years. Japan now owns the whole island chain, masking the eastern sea frontage of Asia, from the tip of Kamchatka to the Philippines, while her acquisition of Germany's Oceanican islands north of the equator gives her important strategic outposts in mid-Pacific. Her bridgeheads on the Asiatic continent are also strong and well-located. From the Korean Peninsula, now an integral part of Japan, she firmly grasps the vast Chinese dependency of Manchuria. While just south of Manchuria, across the narrow waters of the Pekili Strait, lies the rich Chinese province of Shantung, become a Japanese sphere of influence as a result of the late war. Thus, Japan holds China's capital, Peking, as in the jaws of a vice, and can apply military pressure whenever she so desires. In southern China lies another Japanese sphere of influence, the province of Fujian, opposite the Japanese island of Formosa. Lastly, all over China runs a veritable network of Japanese concessions, like the recently acquired control of the great iron deposits near Hankou, far up the Yangtze River in the heart of China. Whether this Japanese imperium over China maintains itself or not, one thing seems certain. Future white expansion in the Far East has become impossible. Any such attempt would instantly weld together Japanese imperialism and Chinese nationalism in a sacred union, whose result would probably be, at the very least, the prompt expulsion of the white man from every foothold in Eastern Asia. That is what will probably come anyway as soon as Japan and China, impelled by overcrowding and conscious of their united potentialities, shall have arrived at a genuine understanding. Since population pressure seems to be the basic factor in the future course of Far Eastern affairs, it would be well to survey possible outlets for surplus population within the Far East itself, in order to determine how much of this race expansion can be satisfied at home, thereby diminishing, or at least postponing, acute pressure upon the political and ethnic frontiers of the white world. To begin with, the population of Japan, approximately 60 million, is increasing at the rate of about 800,000 per year. China has no modern vital statistics, but the annual increase of her 400 million population at the Japanese rate would be 6 million. Now the settled parts of both Japan and China may be considered as fully populated so far as agriculture is concerned, further extensive increases of population being dependent upon the rise of machine industry. Both countries have, however, thinly settled areas within their present political frontiers. Japan's northern island of Hokkaido, Yezo, has a great amount of good agricultural land as yet almost unoccupied. Some of her other island possessions offer minor outlets, while Korea and Manchuria offer extensive colonizing possibilities, albeit Chinese and Korean competition precluded Japanese colonization on the scale which the size and natural wealth of these regions would at first sight seem to indicate. China has even more extensive colonizable areas. Both Mongolia and Chinese Turkestan, though largely desert, contain within their vast areas enough fertile land to support many millions of Chinese peasants as soon as modern roads and railways are built. The Chinese colonization of Manchuria is also proceeding apace, and will continue despite anything Japan may do to keep it down. Lastly, the cold but enormous plateau of Tibet offers considerable possibilities. Allowing for all this, however, it cannot be said that either China or Japan possess within their present political frontiers territories likely to absorb these prodigious accretions of population, which seem destined to occur within the next couple of generations. From the resultant congestion, two avenues of escape will naturally present themselves. Settlement of other portions of the Far East today under white political control, but inhabited by colored populations, and pressure into accessible areas not merely under white political control, but also containing white populations. It is obvious that these are two radically distinct issues. For while a white nation might not unalterably oppose Mongolian immigration into its colored dependencies, it would almost certainly fight to limit rather than witness the racial swamping of land settled by its own flesh and blood. Considering the former issue, then, it would appear that virtually all the peninsulas and archipelagos lying between China and Australia offer attractive fields for yellow, particularly Chinese, race expansion. Ethnically, they are all colored men's lands. Politically, they are all, save Siam, under white control. Britain, France, Holland, and the United States being the titular owners of these extensive territories. So far as the native races are concerned, none of them seem to possess the vitality and economic efficiency needed to maintain themselves against unrestricted Chinese immigration. Whether in the British Straits settlements and North Borneo, French Indochina, the Dutch Indies, the American Philippines, or independent Siam, the Chinaman, so far as he has been allowed, has displayed his practical superiority, and in places where, like the Straits settlements, he has been allowed a free hand, he has virtually supplanted the native stock, reducing the latter to an impotent and vanishing minority. The chief barriers to Chinese race expansion in these regions are legal hindrances on prohibitions of immigration, and of course, such barriers are in their essence artificial and liable to removal under any shift of circumstances. Many observers predict that most of these lands will ultimately become Chinese. Says Aline Ireland, a recognized authority on these regions, quote, "There is every reason to suppose that throughout the tropics, possibly excepting India, the Chinaman, even though he should continue to immigrate in no greater force than hitherto, will gradually supersede all the native races." End quote. Certainly, if this be true, China has here a vast outlet for her surplus population. It has been estimated that the undeveloped portions of the Dutch Indies alone are capable of supporting 100 million people living on the frugal Chinese plain. Their present population is 8 million semi-savages. China's possibilities of race expansion in the colored regions of the Far East are thus excellent. The same cannot be said, however, for Japan. The Japanese, bred in a distinctively temperate island environment, have not the Chinese adaptability to climatic variation. The Japanese, like the white man, does not thrive in tropic heat, nor does he possess the white man's ability to resist subarctic cold. Formosa is not in the real tropics, yet Japanese colonists have not done well there. On the other hand, even the far-from arctic winters of Hokkaido, part of the Japanese archipelago, seem too chilly for the Japanese taste. Japan, thus, does not have the same vital interest as China in the Asiatic tropics. Undoubtedly, they would for Japan be valuable colonies of exploitation, just as they today are thus valuable for white nations. But they could never furnish outlets for Japan's excess population, and even commercially, Japan would be exposed to increasing Chinese competition, since the Chinaman excels the Japanese in trade as well as in migrant colonization. Japanese lack of climatic adaptability is also the reason why Japan's present military excursion in eastern Siberia, even if it should develop into permanent occupation, would yield no adequate solution of Japan's population problem. For the Chinaman, Siberia would do very well. He would breed amazingly there and would fill up the whole country in a remarkably short space of time. But the Japanese peasant, so averse to the winters of Hokkaido, would find the subarctic rigors of Siberia intolerable. Thus, for Japanese migration, neither the empty spaces of northern or southern Asia will do. The natural outlets lie outside Asia in the United States, Australasia, and the temperate parts of Latin America. But all these outlets are rigorously barred by the white man, who has marked them for his own race heritage, and nothing but force will break those barriers down. There lies a danger, not merely to the peace of the Far East, but to the peace of the world, fired by a fervent patriotism, resolved to make the country a leader among the nations. The Japanese writh at the constriction of their present race bounds. Placed on the flank of the Chinese giant, whose portentous growth she can accurately forecast, Japan sees herself condemned to ultimate renunciation of her grandiose ambitions unless she can somehow broaden the racial as well as the political bias of her power. In short, Japan must find lands where Japanese can breed by the tens of millions if she is not to be automatically overshadowed in course of time, assuming that she does not suffocate or blow up from congestion before that time arrives. This is the secret of her aggressive foreign policy, her chronic imperialism, her extravagant dreams of conquest and world domination. The longing to hack a path to greatness by the samurai sword lurks ever in the back of Japanese minds. The library of Nippon's chauvinist literature is large and increasing. A good example of the earlier productions in Satori Kato's brochure titled Mastery of the Pacific, published in 1909. Herein, the author announces confidently, quote, "In the event of war, Japan could, as if aided by a magician's wand, overrun the Pacific with fleets manned by men who have made Nelson their model, and transported to the armadas of the Far East the spirit that was victorious at Trafalgar. Whether Japan avows it or not, her persistent aim is to gain the mastery of the Pacific. Although peace seems to prevail over the world at present, no one can tell how soon the nations may be engaged in war. It does not need the English alliance to secure success for Japan. That alliance may be dissolved at any moment, but Japan will suffer no defeat. Her victory will be won by her men, not by armor plates, things weak by comparison." End quote. The late war has, of course, greatly stimulated these bellicose emotions. Viewing their own increased power and the debilitation of the white world, Japanese jingoes glimpse prospects of glorious fishing in troubled waters. The world dominion note is stressed more often than of yore. For instance, in the summer of 1919, the Tokyo Hochi, Count Okuma's Orion, prophesied exultantly, quote, "That age in which the Anglo-Japanese alliance was the pivot, and American-Japanese cooperation an essential factor of Japanese diplomacy, is gone. In future, we must look eastward for friendship, but not westward. Let the Bolsheviki of Russia be put down and the more peaceful party established in power. In them, Japan will find a strong ally. By marching then westward to the Balkans, to Germany, to France, and Italy, the greater part of the world may be bought under our sway. The tyranny of the Anglo-Saxons at the peace conference is such that it has angered both gods and men. Some may abjectly follow them in consideration of their petty interests, but things will ultimately settle down as has just been indicated." End quote. Still more striking are the following citations from a Japanese imperialist pronouncement written in the autumn of 1916. Quote, "50 millions of our race wherewith to conquer and possess the earth. It is indeed a glorious problem. To begin with, we now have China. China is our steed. Far shall we ride upon her, even as Rome rode Latium to conquer Italy, and Italy to conquer the Mediterranean. Even as Napoleon rode Italy and the Rhenish states to conquer Germany, and Germany to conquer Europe. Even as England today rides her colonies and her so-called allies to conquer her robust rival, Germany. Even so shall we ride China. So becomes our 50 million race 500 million strong. So grow our paltry hundreds of millions of gold into billions. How well have done our people. How well have our statesmen led them. No mistakes. There must be none now. In 1895 we conquered China. Russia, Germany, and France stole from us the booty. How has our strength grown since then, and still it grows. In 10 years we punished and retook our own from Russia. In 20 years we squared and retook from Germany. With France there is no need for haste. She has already realized why we withheld the troops, which alone might have driven the invader from her soil. Her fingers are clutching more tightly around her oriental booty. Yet she knows it is ours for the taking. But there's no need of haste. The world condemns the paltry thief. Only the glorious conqueror wins the plaudits and approval of mankind. We are now well astride of our steed, China, but the steed has long roamed wild and is run down. It needs grooming, more grain, more training. Further, our saddle and bridle are as yet mere makeshifts. Would steed and trapping stand in the strain of war, and what would that strain be? As for America, that fatuous booby with much money and much sentiment, but no cohesion, no brains of government, stood she alone, we should not need our China steed. Well did my friend speak the other day when he called her people a race of thieves with the hearts of rabbits. America, to any warrior race, is not as a foe, but as an immense melon, ripe for the cutting. But there are other warrior races, England, Germany. Would they look on and let us slice and eat our fill? Would they? But, using China as our steed, should our first goal be the land, India, or the Pacific, the sea that must be our very own, even as the Atlantic is now England's? The land is tempting and easy, but withal dangerous. Did we begin there, the coarse white races would soon awaken and combine and forever immure us within our long since grown intolerable bounds. It must therefore be the sea, but the sea means the Western Americas and all the islands between, and with those must soon come Australia, India, and then the battling for the balance of world power for the rest of North America. Once that is ours, we will own and control the whole, a dominion worthy of our race. North America alone will support 1 billion people. That 1 billion shall be Japanese with their slaves. Not arid Asia, nor worn-out Europe, which, with its peculiar and quaint relics and customs, should in the interests of history and culture, be in any case preserved. Nor yet tropical Africa is fit for our people. But North America, that continent so succulently green, fresh, and unsullied, except for the few chattering mongrel Yankees, should have been ours by right of discovery. It shall be ours by the higher, nobler right of conquest. End quote. This apostle of Japanese world dominion then goes on to discuss in detail how his program can best be attained. It should be remembered that at the time he wrote, America was still an unarmed nation, apparently ridden by pacifism. Such imperialist extravagances as the above do not represent the whole of Japan. But they do represent a powerful element in Japan against which the white world should be forewarned. Chapter 3. Brown Man's Land. Brown Man's Land is the Near and Middle East. The brown world stretches in an immense belt clear across southern Asia and northern Africa, from the Pacific to the Atlantic Oceans. The numbers of brown and yellow men are not markedly unequal. 450 million browns as against 500 million yellows. But in most other respects, the two worlds are sharply contrasted. In the first place, while the yellow world is a fairly compact geographical block, the brown world sprawls halfway round the globe and is not only much greater in size, but also infinitely more varied in natural features. This geographical diversity is reflected both in its history and in the character of its inhabitants. Unlike the secluded yellow world, the brown world is nearly everywhere exposed to foreign influences and has undergone an infinite series of evolutionary modifications. Racially, it has been a vast melting pot, or series of melting pots, wherein conquest and migration have continually poured new heterogeneous elements, producing the most diverse racial amalgamations. In fact, there is today no generalized brown type norm, as there are generalized yellow or white type norms, but rather a series of types clearly distinguished from one another. Some of these types, like the Persians and Ottoman Turks, are largely white. Others, like the southern Indians and Yemenite Arabs, are largely black. While still others, like the Himalayan and Central Asian peoples, have much yellow blood. Again, there is no generalized brown culture like those possessed by yellows and whites. The great spiritual bond is Islam, yet in India, the chief seat of brown population, Islam is professed by only 1/5 of the inhabitants. Nevertheless, there is a fundamental committee between the brown peoples. This committee is subtle and intangible in character, yet it exists, and under certain circumstances it is capable of momentous manifestations. Its salient feature is the instinctive recognition by all Near and Middle Eastern peoples that they are fellow Asiatics, however bitter may be their internecine feuds. This instinctive Asiatic feeling has been noted by historians for more than 2,000 years, and it is just as true today as in the past. Of course, it comes out most strongly in face of the non-Asiatic, which in practice has always meant the white man. The action and reaction of the brown and white worlds has indeed been a constant historic factor, the roles of hammer and anvil being continually reversed through the ages. For the last four centuries, the white world has, in the main, been the dynamic factor. Certainly, during the last 100 years, the white world has displayed an unprecedentedly aggressive vigor, the brown world playing an almost passive role. Here again is seen a difference between browns and yellows. The yellow world did not feel the full tide of white aggression till the middle of the last century, while even then it never really lost its political independence, and soon reacted so powerfully that its political freedom has today been substantially regained. The brown world, on the other hand, felt the impact of the white tide much earlier and was politically overwhelmed. The so-called independence of brown states has long been due more to white rivalries than to their own inherent strength. One by one, they have been swallowed up by the white powers. In 1914, only three, Turkey, Persia, and Afghanistan, survived, and the late war has sent them the way of the rest. Turkey and Persia have lost their independence. However, they may still be painted on the map, while Afghanistan has been compelled to recognize white supremacy as never before. Thus, the cycle is fulfilled, and white political mastery over the brown world is complete. Political triumphs, however, of themselves guarantee nothing, and the permanence of the present order of things in the brown world appears more than doubtful when we glance beyond the map. The brown world, like the yellow world, is today in acute reaction against white supremacy. In fact, the brown reaction began a full century ago and has been gathering headway ever since, moved thereto both by its own inherent vitality and by the external stimulus of white aggression. The great dynamic of this brown reaction is the Mohammedan revival. But before analyzing that movement, it would be well to glance at the human elements involved. Four salient groupings stand out among the brown peoples: India, Iran, Arabistan, and Turkestan. The last two words are used in a special sense to denote ethnic and cultural aggregations for which no precise terms have hitherto been coined. India is the population center of the brown world. More than 300 million souls live within its borders, 2/3 of all the brown men on earth. India has not, however, been the brown world's spiritual or cultural dynamic, those forces coming chiefly from the brown lands to the westward. Iran, the Persian plateau, is comparatively small in area and has less than 15 million inhabitants, but its influence upon the brown world has been out of all proportion to its size and population. Arabistan denotes the group of peoples, Arab in blood or Arabized in language and culture, who inhabit the Arabian Peninsula and its adjacent annexes, Syria and Mesopotamia, together with the vast band of North Africa lying between the Mediterranean and the Sahara Desert. The total number of these Arabic peoples is 40 million, 3/4 of them living in North Africa. The term Turkestan covers the group of kindred peoples often called Turanians, who stretch from Constantinople to Central Asia, including the Ottoman Turks of Asia Minor, the Tartars of South Russia and Transcaucasia, and the Central Asian Turkomans. They number in all about 25 million. Such are the four outstanding race factors in the brown world. Let us now examine the spiritual factor, Islam, from which the brown Renaissance originally proceeded, and on which most of its present manifestations are based. Islam's warlike vigor has impressed men's mind ever since the far-off days when its pristine fervor bore the fiery crescent from France to China. But with the passing cycles, this fervor waned, and a century ago, Islam seemed plunged into the stupor of senile decay. The life appeared to have gone out of it, leaving naught but the dry husks of empty formalism and soulless ritual. Yet, at this darkest hour, a voice came crying from out the vast Arabian desert, the cradle of Islam, calling the faithful to do better things. This Puritan reformer was the famous Abd el-Wahhab, and his followers, known as Wahhabis, soon spread over the length and breadth of the Mohammedan world, purging Islam of its sloth and rekindling the fervor of olden days. Thus began the great Mohammedan revival. That revival, like all truly regenerative movements, had its political as well as its spiritual side. One of the first things which struck the reformers was the political weakness of the Muslim world and its increasing subjection to the Christian West. It was during the early decades of the 19th century that the revival spread through Islam, but this was the very time when Europe, recovering from the losses of the Napoleonic Wars, began its unparalleled aggressions upon the Muslim East. The result in Islam was a fusing of religion and patriotism into a sacred union for the combined spiritual regeneration and political emancipation of the Muslim world. Of course, Europe's material and military superiority were then so great that speedy success was recognized to be a vain hope. Nevertheless, with true Oriental patience, the reformers were content to work for distant goals, and the results of their labors, though hidden from most Europeans, was soon discernible to a few keen-sighted white observers. Half a century ago, the learned Orientalist Palgrave wrote these prophetic lines, quote, "Islam is even now an enormous power, full of self-sustaining vitality, with a surplus of aggression, and a struggle with its combined energies would be deadly indeed. The Mohammedan peoples of the East have awakened to the manifold strength and skill of their Western Christian rivals. And this awakening, at first productive of respect and fear, not unmixed with admiration, now wears the type of antagonistic dislike and even of intelligent hate. No more zealous Muslims are to be found in all the ranks of Islam than they who have sojourned longest in Europe and acquired the most intimate knowledge of its sciences and ways. Mohammedans are keenly alive to the ever-shifting uncertainties and divisions that distract the Christianity of today, and to the woeful instability of modern European institutions. From their own point of view, Muslims are as men standing on a secure rock, and they contrast the quiet fixity of their own position with the unsettled and insecure restlessness of all else." End quote. The stability to which Palgrave alludes must not be confused with dead rigidity. Too many of us still think of the Muslim East as hopelessly petrified. But those Westerners best acquainted with the Islamic world assert that nothing could be farther from the truth, emphasizing, on the contrary, Islam's present plasticity and rapid assimilation of Western ideas and methods. Quote, "The alleged rigidity of Islam is a European myth," end quote, says Theodore Morrison, late principal of the Mohammedan Anglo-Oriental Church at Aligarh, India. And another Orientalist, Marmaduke Pickthall, writes, quote, "There is nothing in Islam, any more than in Christianity, which should halt progress. The fact is that Christianity found, some time ago, a modus vivendi with modern life, which Islam has not yet arrived thither. But this process is even now being worked out." End quote. The way in which the Mohammedan world has availed itself of white institutions, such as the newspaper, in forging its new solidarity, is well portrayed by Bernard Temple. Quote, "It all comes to this then," end quote. He writes, quote, "World politics, as viewed by Mohammedanism's political leaders, resolve themselves into a struggle, not necessarily a bloody struggle, but still an intense and vital struggle, for peace and power between the three great divisions of mankind. The Muslim mind is deeply stirred by the prospect. Every Muslim country is in communication with every other Muslim country, directly, by means of special emissaries, pilgrims, travelers, traders, and postal exchanges, indirectly, by means of Mohammedan newspapers, books, pamphlets, leaflets, and periodicals. I have met with Cairo newspapers in Baghdad, Tehran, and Peshawar, Constantinople newspapers in Basra and Bombay, Calcutta newspapers in Mohammera, Kerbela, and Port Said." End quote. These European judgments are confirmed by what Asiatics say themselves. For example, a Syrian Christian, Amin Rehani, thus characterizes the present strength and vitality of the Muslim world. Quote, "A nation of 250 million souls, more than one half under Christian rule, struggling to shake off its fetters, to consolidate its opposing forces, replenish itself in the south, and in the East from the inexhaustible sources of the life primitive, assimilating in the North, but not without discrimination, the civilization of Europe. A nation with a glorious past, a living faith and language, an inspired book, an undying hope, might be divided against itself by European diplomacy, but can never be subjected by European arms. What Islam is losing on the borders of Europe, it is gaining in Africa and Central Asia through its modern propaganda, which is conducted according to Christian methods. And this is one of the grand results, civilization by the benevolent assimilation. Europe drills the Muslim to be a soldier, who will ultimately turn his weapons against her, and she sends her missionaries to awaken in the ulema the proselytizing evil. End quote. Typical of Mohammedan literature on this subject are the following excerpts from a book published at Cairo in 1907 by an Egyptian, Yahya Siddiq, significantly entitled The Awakening of the Islamic Peoples in the 14th Century of the Hegira. The book is doubly interesting because the author has a thorough Western education, holding a law degree from the French University of Toulouse, and is a judge on the Egyptian bench. Although writing as far back as 1907, Yahya Siddiq clearly foresaw the imminence of the European war. Behold, he writes, quote, these great powers, ruining themselves in terrifying armaments, measuring each other's strength with defiant glances, menacing each other, contracting alliances which continually break and which presage those terrible shocks which overturn the world and cover it with ruins, fire, and blood. The future is God's, and nothing is lasting save his will. End quote. He considers the white world degenerate. Quote, does this mean, end quote, he asks, quote, that Europe, our enlightened guide, has already reached the summit of its evolution? Has it already exhausted its vital force by 2 or 3 centuries of hyper-exertion? In other words, is it already stricken with senility, and will it see itself soon obliged to yield its civilizing role to other peoples less degenerate, less neurasthenic? That is to say, younger, more robust, more healthy than itself? In my opinion, the present marks Europe's apogee, and its immoderate colonial expansion means not strength, but weakness. Despite the aureole of so much grandeur, power, and glory, Europe is today more divided and more fragile than ever, and ill conceals its malaise, its sufferings, and its anguish. Its destiny is inexorably working out. The contact of Europe on the East has caused us both much good and much evil. Good in the material and intellectual sense, evil from the moral and political point of view. Exhausted by long struggles, innervated by a brilliant civilization, the Muslim peoples inevitably fell into a malaise. But they are not stricken, they are not dead. These peoples, conquered by the force of cannon, have not in the least lost their unity, even under the oppressive regimes to which the Europeans have long subjected them. I have said that the European contact has been salutary to us from both the material and the intellectual point of view. What reforming Muslim princes wished to impose by force on their Muslim subjects is today realized 100-fold. So great has been our progress in the last 25 years in science, letters, and art, that we may well hope to be in all these things the equals of Europeans in less than half a century. A new era opens for us with the 14th century of the Hegira, and this happy century will mark our renaissance and our great future. A new breath animates the Mohammedan peoples of all races. All Muslims are penetrated with the necessity of work and instruction. We all wish to travel, do business, tempt fortune, brave dangers. There is in the East, among the Mohammedans, a surprising activity, an animation unknown 25 years ago. There is today a real public opinion throughout the East. End quote. The author concludes, quote, let us hold firm, each for all, and let us hope, 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 we are fairly launched on the path of progress. Let us profit by it. It is Europe's very tyranny which has wrought our transformation. It is our continued contact with Europe which favors our evolution and inevitably hastens our revival. It is simply history repeating itself, the will of God fulfilling itself despite all opposition and resistance. Europe's tutelage over Asiatics is becoming more and more nominal. the gates of Asia are closing against the European. Surely we glimpse before us a revolution without parallel in the world's annals. A new age is at hand. End quote. If this be indeed the present spirit of Islam, it is a portentous fact, for its numerical strength is very great. The total number of Mohammedans is estimated at from 200 million to 250 million, and they not only predominate throughout the brown world, with the exception of India, but they also count 10 million adherents in China and are gaining prodigiously among the blacks of Africa. The proselyting power of Islam is extraordinary, and its hold upon its votaries is even more remarkable. Throughout history, there has been no single instance where a people, once become Muslim, has ever abandoned the faith. Extirpated they may have been, like the Moors of Spain, but extirpation is not apostasy. This extreme tenacity of Islam, this ability to keep its hold, once it has got a footing, under all circumstances short of downright extirpation, must be borne in mind when considering the future of regions where Islam is today advancing. And, save in Eastern Europe, it is today advancing along all its far-flung frontiers. Its most signal victories are being won among the Negro races of Central Africa, and this phase will be discussed in the next chapter. But elsewhere, the same conditions in lesser degree prevail. Every Muslim is born a missionary and instinctively propagates his faith among his non-Muslim neighbors. The quality of this missionary temper has been well analyzed by Meredith Townsend. Quote, "All the emotions which impel a Christian to proselytize," end quote, he writes, quote, "are in a Muslim strengthened by all the motives which impel a political leader and all the motives which sway a recruiting sergeant, until proselytism has become a passion, which, whenever success seems practicable, and especially success on a large scale, develops in the quietest Muslim a fury of ardor, which induces him to break down every obstacle, his own strongest prejudices included, rather than stand for an instant in the neophyte's way. He welcomes him as a son, and whatever his own lineage, and whether the convert be Negro, or Chinaman, or Indian, or even European, he will, without hesitation or scruple, give him his own child in marriage, and admit him fully, frankly, and finally into the most exclusive circle in the world." End quote. Such is the vast and growing body of Islam today seeking to weld its forces into a higher unity for the combined objectives of spiritual revival and political emancipation. This unitary movement is known as Pan-Islamism. Most Western observers seem to think that Pan-Islamism centers in the Caliphate, and European writers today hopefully discuss whether the Caliphate's retention by the discredited Turkish sultans, its transference to the rulers of the new Arab Hejaz kingdom, or its total suppression will best clip Islam's wings. This, however, is a very short-sighted and partial view. The Khalifa, or Caliph, to use the Europeanized form, the Prophet's representative on earth, has played an important historic role, and the institution is still venerated in Islam. But the pan-Islamic leaders have long been working on a much broader basis. Pan-Islamism's real driving power lies not in the Caliphate, but in institutions like the Hajj, or pilgrimage to Mecca. The propaganda of the Hablu Matin, or Tie of True Believers, and the great religious fraternities. The Meccan Hajj, where tens of thousands of picked zealots gather every year from every quarter of the Muslim world, is really an annual pan-Islamic congress where all the interests of the faith are discussed at length, and where plans are elaborated for its defense and propagation. Similarly ubiquitous is the pan-Islamic propaganda of the Hablu ul-Matin, which works tirelessly to compose sectarian differences and traditional feuds. Lastly, the religious brotherhoods cover the Islamic world with a network of far-flung associations, quickening the zeal of their myriad members and coordinating their energies for potential action. The greatest of these brotherhoods, though there are others of importance, is the famous Senussia, and its history well illustrates Islam's evolution during the past 100 years. Its founder, Sayyid Mohammed bin Senussi, was born in Algeria about the beginning of the 19th century. He was of high Arab lineage, tracing his descent from Fatima, the daughter of the Prophet. In early youth, he went to Arabia and there came under the influence of the Wahhabi movement. In middle life, he returned to Africa, settling in the Sahara Desert, and there built up the fraternity which bears his name. Before his death, the order had spread to all parts of the Mohammedan world, but it is in northern Africa that it has attained its peculiar preeminence. The Senussi order is divided into local zawiyas, or lodges, all absolutely dependent upon the Grand Lodge, headed by the master, El Senussi. The Grand Mastership still remains in the family, a grandson of the former being the order's present head. The Senussi stronghold is an oasis in the very heart of the Sahara. Only one European eye has ever seen this mysterious spot, surrounded by absolute desert, with wells many leagues apart, and the routes of approach known only to experienced Senussi guides, every one of whom would suffer 1,000 deaths rather than betray him. El Senussi, the master, sits serenely apart, sending his orders throughout North Africa. The Sahara itself is absolutely under Senussi control, while Zawiyas abound in distant regions like Morocco, Lake Chad, and Somaliland. These local Zawiyas are more than mere lodges. Their spiritual and secular heads, the Makadim, or priest, and the Wakil, or civil governor, have discretionary authority not merely over the Zawiyi members, but also over the community at large. At least, so great is the awe inspired by the Senussi throughout North Africa that a word from Wakil or Makadim is always listened to and obeyed. Thus, beside the various European authorities, British, French, or Italian, as the case may be, there exists an occult government with which the colonial authorities are careful not to come into conflict.
Context of white supremacy. So we are still in chapter 3, midpoint chapter 3. We will close that out during the second audio segment. This is our second installment, Lothrop Stoddard, The Rising Tide of Color Against White World Supremacy. If you would like to participate, the number to dial is 641-715-3640, and the code is 564-943-pound. Press star 6 if you would like to participate. That number again, 641-715-3640. The code is 564-943-pound. Press star 6 if you would like to participate. I remind folks again, Dr. Welsing, strongly encouraged. I will have a different audio segment next week of Dr. Welsing talking about this book, but she strongly encouraged that victims of racism study this book seriously and see if it has useful information to help us understand racism, white supremacy in 2016 and how to go about solving this problem immediately. So keep that in mind, and just to have her spirit here with us as we review the material. If you want to participate and you do not want to use your phone, you can use the free VOPE line. It is linked at Black Talk Radio Network. If you need the address, it is tiny.ty.cc/1race. And that is the number 1. Address again, tiny.ty.cc/1race. And that is the number 1. Once you put in that address, click the link on the left of the page. It says free VOPE line. When you click it, it will open a small window on your screen. The first line, it is a drop-down menu. Select the number I just gave out, which again is 641-715-3640. The next line, it will ask for the code. That code again is 564-943. Final line. It will ask for a name. You can use your real name, nickname. You can press random keys, whatever you're comfortable with. Once you get all that information entered, click the green button. It will connect you to the live broadcast. You should be able to hear us. It is the same procedure. If you would like to participate, you will see the dial pad on your screen. Press star 6, and then you'll hear the audio prompt. Press the number 1. I'll see your hand on the screen, and we can get you on the line. If folks have commentary they would like to share, your line should be open. Feel free to participate.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Greetings, Gus, and greetings, everybody on the call. Real interesting discussion with the Asians. It goes to show you how much of a great propagandist Lapper Stoddard is. I mean, he makes racism seem so nice, and he basically kind of refines it. I mean, the way he talks about the Japanese is just unbelievable. You know, he makes them into these imperialists. They're looking to take over the world. And yet he mentions nothing about, you know, European domination or even American domination during that time as well. So I found that to be, you know, very interesting the way he describes the Japanese people, these Asian people trying to take over the world, you know, and we need to stop them because, you know, they're gonna just soak up the world in their Japanese culture. Which they never, you know, recognize as a modern culture. He briefly talked about the Treaty of Versailles, which is at the end of World War One, and in Japan, and so interesting because they initially didn't even invite Japan to the treaty when that happened, and that's what really upset the Japanese in regards to that Treaty of Versailles. So. That was interesting as well. In regards to the chapter of the brown man, it gives you a good insight of why white supremacists tried to suppress the Islamic culture and why Islam is so hated amongst white supremacists. It gives a good insight of that and the historical content of it. So I thought it was very productive to know, you know, just in case people wonder why Islam is so hated, you know, amongst Anglo-Saxon, especially Anglo-Saxon Americans. Because, you know, it's like Islam is not a race or anything like that, but this gives a good definition of why white supremacists, you know, hate Islam because of the connection to, you know, non-white people or brown people as or Arabs as people like to classify them. The one thing that I wanted to throw out there to you guys or somebody else is, you know, I kind of find it like with non-white Asians, especially, you know, Chinese and Japanese, I often wonder if their aim of, because it's like they seem to know where they stand at with, you know, within the world of white supremacy. You know, they know that, you know, the white man is their enemy, and, you know, they understand that, but it doesn't seem like they're looking to end white supremacy. There seems like their aim is to just be protected from it, you know, instead of just ending it. 'Cause it seems like for instance, with China, they just want to protect their own part of the world. To keep away white people, but they're not looking to end white supremacy as a whole. I kind of see that, you know, now and throughout history. I mean, maybe I might be wrong, but, just something to kind of throw out there. But I guess that's about it with the book. That's all I have for my comments.
Grand. Other folks that we have not heard from have commentary you want to share? Feel free.
Hey, can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, man. This book, you know, it to me, you know, the words, and I guess it's like, you know, it's been back in 20, but the words, and it's just very refined. And I know that when white people get to talking about their history and, you know, they, you know, whatever, politics and all, everything is, oh, man, it's extreme, you know. And what I want to ask is, pertaining to it, is what is, because I don't got the code book, right? But I want to try to find out if anybody got this book in hand or close by, the definition for war. Because, you know, because we're dealing with this book, and it's like, and you know, when you hear, when you go through the guests, you know, everybody seems to agree that war has been declared on us, right? And I just want to find out what their definition, what people mean when they say war. Because, yeah, this is very, this is, you know, yeah, it's some strange language in their book, man. But I think it kind of, it really just telling us what we already know, and, you know, most of the ancestors already know. And, yeah, man, with that, I'm going to mute my line, man. Thank you.
Appreciate that. I do. I'm not at my residence, so I'm not able to immediately put my hand on my code book from Mr. Fuller to get that. But if you have any listeners who are close to your code book and can nab that, much obliged. Anybody else who had commentary that we have not heard from? Other folks who have commentary?
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Greetings to you, Gus. Greetings to the callers and the listeners. I think the second caller made a really salient point on bringing that up, and I think that's something we should look into. I'm not immediately near my code book. Hopefully I'll be able to get there. Once I am, I'll look it up. And the first caller really did an impeccable job as far as him speaking about China and Japan and how Lathrop started to address that, and him pointing out the fact that he was a brilliant propagandist. That is absolutely accurate. So I won't really get into China and Japan as much, but this book is just really, really a potent exposition of white supremacy and how white people think. And to have a Harvard-level white predator write a book like this is extremely insightful. And like Dr. Wilson always is, her insight is just profound, and just recommending this book speaks volumes to her brilliance. On page 24, the author writes, "These mighty racial ties flow from the most elemental of vital urges, self-expansion and self-preservation. Both outward thrust of expanding life and counter thrust of threatened life are equally normal phenomena." And that two sentences that he wrote, I find to be very important, because this kind of shows that white people think that everyone else that's non-white thinks like they do. And the way that they think is self-expansion and self-preservation, which of course means preventing genetic annihilation at all costs. Self-expansion would be just expanding white supremacy to every known corner of the universe that they can make it to. And the way that it's written, where he says it's, they're equally normal phenomena, where he's practicing racism, is that he's not being accurate in the point of stating that that's normal phenomena for white people. That is the way that they function. That is the way that they've always functioned. There was quite a bit I highlighted, so I'm not going to, you know, try to bring up too much, but there was just quite a bit that's very important that that he brought up here. On page 35, he writes, "The Mohammedan people of the West have awakened to the manifold strength and skill of their Western Christian rivals. And this awakening, at first productive of respect and fear, not unmixed with admiration, now wears the type of antagonistic dislike and even of intelligent hate. No more zealous Muslims are to be found in all of the ranks of Islam than they who have sojourned longest in Europe and acquired the most intimate knowledge of its sciences and ways. Mohammedans are keenly alive to the ever-shifting uncertainties and divisions that distract the Christianity of today and to the woeful instability of modern European institutions. From their own point of view, Muslims are as men standing on a secure rock, and they contrast the quiet fixity of their own position with the unsettled and insecure restlessness of all else. And that's a quote from Palgrave. And what I find is really important about what he's saying here is he's saying that basically the Muslims, by being in Europe, have picked up the way white supremacy functions, and as what Dr. John Henry Clark would have called the buffer class of people, because they are mixed race people themselves, they have now started to pick up on how white supremacy functions and are using Islam as the means to perpetuate it, which is one of the reasons I think white people, like the previous caller said, hate Islam, especially in America, because they realize that Arabs are able to use Islam and have in similar ways that white people have used white supremacy, but yet they have not been as successful as the true original terrorists. He's not also speaking of the fact that it was the Moors that actually brought Europe out of the Dark Ages and saved white people from total annihilation after the plague. And also that there were two types of Moors that were there, the Blacker Moors, which were the Africans that were dark-skinned, and then you had the Tawny Moors, which were basically the mixed-race Arabs that we see, that we would associate with Arabia today. So I find it telling that they're speaking of Muslims learning so much from being around Europeans, when in reality it was the other way around, when black people ruled Europe for almost 800 years. On the following page, he writes, what Islam is losing on the borders of Europe, it is gaining in Africa and Central Asia through its modern propaganda, which is conducted according to Christian methods. And this is one of the grand results of civilization by benevolent assimilation. Europe drills the Muslim to be a soldier who will ultimately turn his weapon against her. She sends her missionaries to awaken the ulama, the proselytizing evil, which is speaking to what I just discussed about them using Islam the way whites have used Christianity. Also, when they speak about the way that it's spreading in Africa, a lot of times it was spread through Africa via the sword. So if you did not embrace Islam, basically they would behead you on the spot. And even in a lot of parts of Africa today where Sharia law is not popular or powerful, you find that a lot of Africans that practice Islam in secret actually go to African traditional priests to get real medical help, real psychological and spiritual help, and they'll, you know, put on the trappings of Islam that they wear in public. The results of civilization by benevolent assimilation, that also speaks to one of the other methods that Arabs used to spread Islam, which was to come in a peaceful way and just proselytize the way that Christian missionaries go to Africa and proselytize today. So they had that approach in some areas, and then they had the volatile approach where it was behead you if you don't accept Islam right here on the spot. I'll stop there and give other callers a chance to speak. Hopefully I'll be able to bring up a couple of things later. Thank you, and I'll mute my line.
For sure, Roz. 1842, did you have commentary?
Can I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Greetings, everybody. I have the definition for war, which I'll read first, and then we'll give some of my commentary. It's kind of lengthy, but I'll just give it really quick. And it says, war. Use this word with caution. When others use words like war, non-war, and or peace, ask for a detailed explanation that you can easily understand. When you use the word war, use it to apply to any conflict between two or more persons that includes the intent of doing unjust harm to one or more persons. Use it also to apply to any willful and deliberate unjust harm done by any person against another person. When applying the word war to the system of white supremacy racism, use the term the war. As long as white supremacy racism exists, use the term counter-war and or counter-racist war to apply to anything said or done that proves effective in replacing white supremacy racism with justice, balance between people. The word war can and should be used to apply to those things said or done that help to maintain injustice, imbalance between people. The term the war should always be used to describe or apply to those things that directly or indirectly help to maintain, expand, and or refine the practice of white supremacy, racism, in any one or more areas of activity. All other conflicts between people should be called battles, fights, violent acts, major disagreements, etc. A couple of things that I was thinking about is there's a lot that he's not saying because he talks a lot. It's, for me, extremely verbose, and which makes me feel like he's, like, hiding something. And I think it's very interesting for the book to be about race. He's not really talking. Like, there's, like, a little bit of mention, but not significant. I would think that there would be substantial more monologuing about why it's so important, which would be because white people are such a small percentage of the world population. And what I mean is they're always knowing how many so-called Muslims there are or Japanese there are. But we're not talking about how many Europeans or white people there is at the same time. And so I think that's very interesting. You have all of this stuff, all of these words, all this information, really keeping you away from thinking, well, we have this millions of Japanese or this millions of Arabians, where we have this thousands of Europeans. And there was a few other things like that are just like that. Like, for instance, there's so much talk about, like, colors of people, but not really talking, like, you just dismiss the black person altogether, which is really the strongest person when we talk about color. Because to talk about Russians, to talk about Asians, yes, all of them being non-white, or, you know, certain types of Russians being non-white, but it's such a big issue because we're talking about color, which means that the entire continent that's just been dismissed up until this point is really the most powerful people, or the one that you're really, really scared of. But you can easily make it, like, it's a very, for me, underhanded, manipulative way of dismissing the most powerful is just to dismiss them altogether. And we're going to talk about everybody else when really who we're really, really afraid of, I just said they're nobody. I don't know if I'm being cohesive in expressing that thought, but in all of that talking, those are like two things that I took away, that by keeping so much other stuff in people's faces, you're not really talking to the potency and power of the group that you're ultimately attempting to destroy and dominate. I have a few other things, but I just wanted to formulate my thoughts a little bit more before I comment on those, but thank you for letting me share.
Appreciate that. If other folks have commentary they would like to share, please do not wait till the last minute. Go ahead and get a hand up. We'll have more time before we get to the second audio segment. Before I begin my commentary, just make sure I get my gratitude in to our narrator and Mel, our editor, putting the audio together. Really appreciate the effort. As Gusty has said before, I am no fan of reading narrating for the book study session, so I'm elated to not have to read this. Audio has been grand for the first 2 weeks. Looking forward to continuing. Also wanted to get in quickly that in reference to, I think, one of the first people that dialed in, they were saying that they see, I guess, amongst non-white, non-black people, quote-unquote Asians, that they don't seem like they're vested in ending white supremacy. They just seem like they're okay with whatever comfortable spot that they have, not being black people, the most mistreated, the most abused. I see a considerable number of black people as well who are not really investing their time and energy in trying to solve this problem that's general amongst the system of white supremacy. In fact, that's what the system is supposed to produce, victims who are not trying to solve this problem. I could be in error. The caller at 4757. Did you have commentary? 4757?
Yes, can I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, I had 2 points. The second one's a little bit longer. In chapter one, the remaining part of chapter two, I think that there might be something to Stoddard's calculation of Japan as a power in the East. When I look at East Asian countries mentioned in the text, the countries seem to have gained like a little bit of autonomy, like China and Japan and then today Korea, although that's not mentioned too much. And I would argue that that has something to do with the whitened images of the people that come out of China and Japan and Korea. Like if I have to think of white people's interest in Asian people, one thing that jumps to my mind is I think statistically when white men marry interracially, they marry Asian women. And two, in chapter three, considering that the book was written in 1920, I wasn't actually aware of how long white supremacists have been at war with Islam or Muslims or seeing them as a threat. One of the things Stoddard points out as potentially problematic in the Muslim world is their ability to organize constantly, so much that they have secret organizations. And of course, that all non-white people are just constantly scheming against white people, so there's that. But it's kind of an interesting question to me then why many Muslim people today are considered white in the U.S., even if they are Muslim, or Middle Eastern people are considered white, even if they are Muslim. But the media will tell you that if a so-called white Muslim person should commit or even be suspected of committing a crime, they are suddenly considered Muslim again by the news media, and they lose all their like honorary whiteness. I also think it's worth noting right now that in the U.S., I heard as of last year, they're considering adding a new category called Middle Eastern people from North Africa to the U.S. Census for race. And that some people are speculating that just by 2020, they will no longer be using the race at all, word race at all in the census. So I guess just expect confusion down the line. Don't know what we'll be calling ourselves in 2020. I think they just said check off categories that describe you. So that could be anything. That was all my comments for now. Thank you.
Appreciate that. Anybody else that has comments that we haven't heard from, go ahead, get a hand up. If you have thoughts you'd like to share before we get to the second audio segment. Let's see, some of the things that I noted in the text. The portion, this is in kind of the beginning portion of chapter two. He's talking about Japan. He quotes an author who's talking about the potential for an alliance with Germany. I had to remember this book was written in 1920, so this is almost two decades roughly before World War II, and that did happen where you get the German-Japanese alliance. I think that's something that's important, just racists looking way down the road at things that they think might happen. Speculation, and I think a lot of times just keeping in mind, number one, racists, they make 500-year plans. Number two, I think your predictions and looking at what might happen, I think you can be much more accurate having a better understanding of racism, white supremacy. The next portion where he says Japanese foreign policy has one minimum objective: Japan as hegemon of a Far East in which white influence shall have been reduced to a vanishing quantity. That is the bald truth of the matter, and no white man has any reason for getting indignant about it. I think just this consistent notion, I think the first caller who chimed in who said that he recognized this as propaganda, which in my view it totally is. White supremacy, I think, is the greatest propaganda machine in the world. It requires constant propaganda in all areas of people activity. But it reminds me also of Dr. Francis Cress Welsing, White Genetic Annihilation, White Inferiority coming through as well in this text, and a lot of projection. Any black people, any non-white people that are looking to be successful, independent, to go out and do as much as they possibly can. That represents a threat to the global white minority. And a lot of projecting white people's behavior and their terrorist activity, collective terrorist activity, onto non-white people. I thought that was an example of that right there. Pops up at other points in the text as well. Moving forward, he says, these racial tides flow from the most elemental of vital urges, self-expansion and self-preservation. I thought that was a real clear Dr. Welsing moment. Both outward thrust of expanding life and counter thrust of threatened life are equally normal phenomena. To condemn the former as criminal and the latter as selfish is either silly or hypocritical and tends to envenom the unnecessary rancor. What objective fairness might keep a candid struggle inevitable, yet alleviated by mutual comprehension and respect? I think one of our previous female callers, she talked about how verbose it is and all of that. It just lot buckets of words, I think we have said before, and just a lot of rhetoric to cover that this is just white genetic annihilation and talking about, and I think even the caller that in North Dakota who asked about war, I thought that was great as well, because racism is war. Someone should make that a blog. We already have war, and we already have that. He's talking about there might be war between whites and non-whites, and for me, that's a part of this same pattern of talking about racism as though this is some sort of, you know, spat between equals. That's not what this is at all. This is one tiny minority of people who have declared war on the entire planet and all the other people that they say are not a member of their race on the planet. That's what this is. That's the most accurate way of describing this. And I think they invest a lot of time and energy, generally successfully, in getting us to think of this as though, yes, we all signed up and we are a part of this quote unquote race and competition. That's not what this is at all. We should, you know, speak accurately about that. Let's see. Next, the portion. Where he says the struggles will lose half their bitterness and the wars, if wars there must be, will be shorn of half their ferocity. Just struck me as a lot of rhetoric, rhetorical rhetoric, and just unnecessary hyperbole. We're talking about whites like Lothrop Stoddard. This is the intellectual foundation of white supremacy that justifies, that mandates, that rationalizes dropping an atomic bomb, a weapon of mass destruction, on Japanese people in roughly a quarter of a century from when this book was published. This is the justification for that act. And Agent Orange, later on in Vietnam, which is still wreaking havoc on non-white people in that part of the world, and even some U.S. troops. You got to have some, you know, white sacrifice in there too. But this Lothrop Stoddard and Madison Grant, whites like this, set the framework for justifying these sort of barbaric white acts for decades, for centuries. And they have the gall to make this sort of statement that, you know, we can, you know, be civilized about all of this. They'll use terminology like that frequently to try to make this sound, euphemisms to try to make this sound better than what it actually is. And that's just a total commitment to terrorism and slaughtering non-white people on a global scale. Let's see, what else? This is a major theme of the book. This is our second session. He writes, any such attempt would instantly weld together. And this is if whites were to try to expand into the far east. He says, any such attempt would instantly weld together Japanese imperialism and Chinese nationalism in a sacred union whose result would probably be, at the very least, the prompt expulsion of the white man from every foothold in Eastern Asia. This theme has come up over and over again. I think this is at the core, at least my interpretation. I think with Islam, I think it's more that it's racial. I think Madison Grant made that explicit last week, and I think a few other times he's just made that so clear, getting back to the title. And even I'm in agreement with the female caller that dialed in before, where it's so wordy, but he is frequently not getting to the crux of this being about white genetic annihilation and whites being threatened because they are the minority on the planet in considering the population of people that have melanin. And I think with Islam, it's not the religion. It's that these are individuals that they have classified as non-white. So any organizing or structure, code, if you will, that is being proselytized through Islam, it's a threat because these are non-white people. If these were white people, this wouldn't be an issue at all. This would just be another great, cool piece of technology we could use to spread white supremacy and dominate the Negroes worldwide. But these are non-white people, so this is a problem. He talked about that last week as well. The Negroes organizing in any way, shape, form, looking like they are working together. Oh, this is horrendous for white people. And he articulates that over and over and over. That seems like that's going to be one of the big takeaways from the book. Any time that non-white people are minimizing conflict amongst each other and trying to work together in a codified counter-racist fashion, that is a major problem for racist man, racist woman, racist child. Let's see. Moving forward. I think this portion, a lot of this sounds like it could have been written today. When he talks about Islam and when he talks about the threat of immigrants flooding into non-white areas, so it sounds like I could be talking, listening to Bill Maher's coming on in a few hours, or Bill O'Reilly, or President-elect Donald Trump. A lot of the white Marine Le Pen in France. It sounds like I could be listening to a lot of the concerns that they are articulating right now on the doorstep of 2017. Just in my view, showing, number one, the continuance of racism, white supremacy, that they just have some core beliefs, notions that are just going to be there throughout years and years and years. They end up being timeless aspects of how whites function, what white culture is, white supremacy, racism is, what it means to be white. The continued notion, this is where he says, from the resultant congestion, two avenues of escape will naturally present themselves: settlement of other portions of the Far East today under white political control, but inhabited by colored populations, and pressure into accessible areas not merely under white political control, but also containing white populations. It is obvious that these are two radically distinct issues, for while a white nation might not unalterably oppose Mongolian immigration into its colored dependencies, it would almost certainly fight to limit rather than witness the racial swamping of lands settled by its own flesh and blood. This is putting up a wall. This is Donald Trump. You hear this right today, November 2016. The metaphors, I think, are really interesting as well. But this notion that, you know, we're going to be invaded and all these, you know, dark people are going to come in and change our way of life, and Islamophobia and the Islam. This was what... the terrorist in Norway, Anders Breivik, this is the same type of rhetoric that he said in his lengthy manifesto in 2011. Same types of fears that I think, again, get at what the female caller said. It's not saying white genetic annihilation, but that's what it is. That's what it is. Very verbose presentation. I did want to get in as well. The use of the term thrust, I think, in this writing for me is very sexual connotation. Getting back to the genital level, again, Welsing moment when he said that before, this thrust when he was talking about the invasion of non-white people. Let's see. Maybe I'll get in one or two more and then we'll check in with some of our listeners. Also wanted to make sure I mentioned, I posted the debate that I mentioned last week online. I had a listener who hooked me up and sent the document. The debate between Lothrop Stoddard and W.E.B. Du Bois from 1929, Shall the Negro Be Encouraged to Seek Cultural Equality? You can check it out. It's transcribed, so you can see what everybody said. It is fascinating. They spent some time talking about the definition of what we mean when we say culture, what we mean when we say equality, even what we mean when we say Negro. It is interesting. Check it out. If you've read it, you can feel free to insert your comments this week or as we proceed with the reading. I have read it, so I might comment this week. I have to see how we do with time. One more comment from the text. I think I had quite a bit of notes this week as well. Let's see. One last comment. I think his contempt for non-white people is not veiled. I think he's pretty consistent in the way that he talks about non-white people, that these are just savages, brutes, people that, you know, should be mistreated, people that we should be dominating. I mean, these are clearly people that are, or they're not even people, but these are clearly beings who are not equal to whites. And the natural order of the world is for us to dominate and abuse them. I think that comes through consistently throughout the text. His use of the term breed when he's talking about non-white people, I think that's a Welsing moment. And again, that's one of those, in my view, where you're using terms like that that are making the sexual component, the white genetic annihilation, that make that clearer than what he's actually saying when he's using terms in this manner that consistently are going back to procreation, reproduction, white genetic annihilation, us being a minority on a planet dominated by people who are classified as not white. Let's see. The last one I'll end with, the portion where he says, where he's talking about brown people. So this is chapter 3, where he says, it's salient feature is instinctive recognition by all Near and Middle Eastern peoples that they are fellow Asiatics. However bitter may be their internecine feuds, this instinctive Asiatic feeling has been noted by historians for more than 2,000 years, and it is just as true today as in the past. Of course, it comes out most strongly in face of the non-Asiatic, which in practice has always meant the white man. I thought this was staggering for many reasons. Propaganda, again. I mean, this is just like, if you are a racist, if you are classified as white, you can stick a degree behind your name. I have a PhD. I went to Harvard or Yale or wherever you went to. I went to Oxford. You know, I'm white. I have all these degrees and what have you. So I can just say whatever I want. You could just make up things out. What are you even talking about? This Asiatic feeling that we have, that we are all in this together amongst all these different groups of people. There is some genetic coding that, hey, we are all cool because we are. I mean, what are you even talking about? And I think this is so dangerous because, again, that notion of race, there's one race, the white race, nobody else signed up, nobody else joined up. I think it totally benefits and strengthens the system of white supremacy when they trick non-white people into thinking, yes, we sat down and joined some sort of race as Asiatics or black people or whatever else it is, when we totally did not. And then we get frustrated when we are not cooperating as fellow members of the same race, and then we end up having all these problems amongst each other. The only folks who have done this are whites. That is clear. That is self-evident. But it struck me just on so many levels, the folly of it, to make this sort of thing up, that these folks are all in this together, and it can be documented by history. It's been documented for 2,000 years, and he just goes on about this, and whites do this sort of thing all the time. They get to come out and flex their white expert card and say whatever they want, and it just gets to be taken as gospel because, you know, this is an Ivy League historian, so, you know, he said what he said. That's how you end up with things. They had the Rolling Stone article today where in court, they reviewed that they had wronged UVA and printed this and said this, and then they had to retract the article. I will stop there to make sure other folks have an opportunity to comment. I don't think we missed anybody. Other folks have additional comments they wanted to make sure they got in?
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Yes. There were two things I wanted to touch on. The first thing is he gives out some interesting but partial information on page 39. He writes in the beginning of a chapter there, "This, however, is a very short-sighted and partial view. The Khalifa, or Caliph, to use the Europeanized form, the Prophet's representative on earth, has played an important historic role, and the institution is still venerated in Islam." Well, he spells Khalifa one way, K-H-A-L-I-F-A, and then Caliph, C-A-L-I-P-H. And both of those terms are valid. The Caliph with a C is actually the highest ranking military So military person in Islam. And the Khalifa with a K-H or Caliph is the highest ranking spiritual person or the next person in line underneath Muhammad to lead the faith. So he only gives one of those meanings, and he calls this C-letter one a Europeanized form, which I don't know it to be. I always, throughout my life, have known that word to be spelled both ways, and they both meant different things. And that's all I wanted to speak on with that. The other thing is on the following page, right before the chapter ended, and also I wanted to just give a shout-out to Mel and also to the narrator as well. He's doing a phenomenal job. So I've been wanting to do that from the beginning, so I just want to get that in. He writes, the Sahara itself is absolutely under Spinozi control, while Zawiyas, bound in distant regions like Morocco, Lake Chad, and Somaliland, these local Zawiyas are more than mere lodges. Their spiritual and secular heads, the Mokadim, or priest, and the Wakil, or civil governor, have discretionary authority not merely over the Zawiya members, but also over the community at large. At least so great is the awe inspired by the Senussi throughout North Africa that a word from Wakil or Mokadim is always listened to and obeyed. Thus, beside the various European authorities, British, French, or Italian, as the case may be, there exists an occult government with which the colonial authorities are careful not to come into contact. This is just the most rhetorical, ethical nonsense I've ever seen. How are white people the invaders of an area in North Africa? They instate the system of white supremacy, but yet there's a group of traditional Islamic or Islamized African priests who they're careful not to come into conflict with, when they can just overrun the place with white soldiers, shoot everybody, or bomb them to smithereens and call it a day. You know, I mean, I do know that there are spiritual leaders that do have influence over the people that might be able to get them to rise up. But any rising up that they're doing against white people is going to be suppressed and annihilated very quickly and efficiently. So that right there is just an act of racism for him to give the impression that these spiritual leaders have so much power that the white people are just scared of them. And, you know, they have to be careful not to come into conflict with them. It's laughable. Thank you. And I'll meet my line.
The caller is 6361. 6361. Did you have commentary?
This is Ken Steele. I am just curious to know, is the author interpreting Islam as only non-white people, or is he including, they use the word tawny to describe the lighter skin? Muslims in this case, are they considering all Muslims to be non-white? I'm just curious.
To me, it sounds very similar to the way I hear Islam talked about today, where there seems to be some sort of acknowledgement that there are individuals who are classified as white who practice Islam, who would be called Muslims. But the impression is given that the majority of people who are Muslims, practice Islam, are non-white. Thus, they are enemies, if that makes sense. Yes, we acknowledge there are some individuals classified as white who do practice Islam. And at times, it even, to me at least, it's almost suggested that these individuals might have compromised their quote-unquote white classification based on practicing Islam, being a Muslim. Sometimes, not always, sometimes. But okay. Generally, if you are Muslim, generally non-white. That's the impression that I get.
Okay. My question is, for the listeners, have anybody noticed that a lot of the people that they're showing as, so-called refugees from the conflict in Syria, it seems to me that a number of these people appear to be white. I don't know what to make of them. They appear to be white to me. And I feel like there are a group of, Muslims that they seem to be in with white culture. I'm looking at the history of the family, House of Saud, and they seem to be all white people. I'm looking at these people, And the leader of Syria, I think Bashar, he seems to be a blue-eyed white man. He looks like a tall, blue-eyed white man. So I get really confused when they talk about Muslims and Islam as a racial classification versus any other, versus a religious orientation. Is this something else that everybody else is picking up on, or am I the only person that's very confused by this?
Any responses?
Oh, yeah, man. I remember one time Mr. Fuller was saying about they were having some little problems over there, and they shut it down. I think they do kind of look white, but I mean, I don't know why they being treated the way they're being treated over there. I mean, because I've seen some of them on the news myself, and they do look white.
Take one more.
I was going to say, definitely, I would say the Syrians do look white. They're heavily mixed with Europeans today, so a lot of them tend to look white. But definitely, those white people who practice Islam, I believe, are not, like you said, their white card is revoked. Because even the Boston bombers, the place where they're from in Chechnya, those people practice Islam, and they're not treated like white people. They're treated like non-white people as far as the abuse that they suffer from the government and things of that nature. They're just a heavily abused people. So I believe, like you said, you were accurate when you stated that those white people who do practice Islam are basically looked at as separate, even though they will acknowledge that they're white. So I agree with you on that. And I'm on mute, my line.
I think we talked about that before, I think, on one of the broadcasts, and the confusion about whether the individuals that they are classifying as Syrian refugees or Syrian migrants, what is their racial classification? Are these folks classified as white or not white? I, too, think that that has caused some confusion, where some of these folks do look like they're pretty pale, like they might, some of them, might be able to be classified as white. That would be a good question to ask some, maybe even some white guests we get on the program, or some of the whites, to see what they say. And also to your question about the confusion, I think that happens a lot, and it's probably deliberate. If you are racist man, racist woman, you make decisions about racial classification so you don't get confused. It's non-whites. We get confused when they are talking about any issue and they're not being explicit about the racial classification, the racial element of what's happening, and they're using other terms. I think that is just a part of it, where we get confused, non-white people, when they do that sort of thing. I was going to point out one other passage that I thought was pretty filled with propaganda. Did any other folks have comments on the passage where he talks about this instinctive Asiatic feeling that I just read? Did that stand out to anybody else, or was that just me, in terms of me thinking that was a pretty striking passage for some of the reasons I outlined?
Absolutely. I thought, as soon as you brought it up, I thought projection. They're projecting the mindset of white supremacy onto Muslims, essentially. They're basically saying, oh, they think like us. There's this feeling they get. You know, it's that feeling of, you know, the prevention of their genetic annihilation. You know, it's really, that's what it is. It's subconscious projection of what white people actually do on non-white people. And there's no feeling we get. Like you said, there is no black race where we just get this feeling. It's not like that. Like, it's hilarious. But yes, it's absolute propaganda nonsense.
And even just, I mean, the additional absurdity of it, this passage is not even Muslims. This is Middle Eastern peoples. Put that in quotes. So some of these people are Muslims. Some of them are not. But they still have this common instinctive Asiatic feeling beyond their religious practice.
And I would love to see how that works, because they kill each other wholesale out there, too. So what feeling do they have? Like, they bomb each other. They do all kinds of stuff to each other. So I don't know what feeling they get. Really weird.
I thought the exact same thing. But, you know, hey, I didn't get a degree from Harvard. So what do I know? The caller at 9828. Did you have commentary?
It's about Islam, and I just don't want to be too far off topic. I just would like to know, has any other guest ever traveled to Mali, and how would they feel about traveling smiling. And I mute my line, but I was just wanted to ask that one question and just hear from everybody.
I have not. I'm not really sure what that has to do with the book per se. I will table that. If folks want to respond once we get to the end, I'll make sure to bring up your caller in Alabama, his question, so people can respond. But that, unless I'm just ignorant, which certainly could be, doesn't seem directly related to the book. Right. Other folks have any commentary that they wanted to get in, book related? We have about 6 minutes before we get to the second audio clip. Any other folks have book related commentary?
Yeah, hey, can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
I wanted to just say something about my VGQ, man. I mean, do it seem to anybody like that these intellectual, supposed to be intellectual white people that write these books and do all this talking, man, don't they seem like to be the most violent and the most, like, sexual, aggressive, or of the people? I mean, these is the people that's leading everybody else into this behavior, right? And it seems like the ones, like, even when you look at the ones that we got now, these are the ones that's doing, I mean, everybody partaking in it, but it's supposed to be these ones that's so small and they use all these words, like this guy in this book, he using all these words and he sound like he a professor at a university or something. But all his language is just violent and sexual. And with that, I'm going to mute my line, man. Thank you.
Great point. That I pointed out some of the words thrust and breed being used extensively. And, I mean, really, that's what we're talking about. You know, you can use a lot of polysyllabic terms where you can sound really eloquent. And show off your Harvard education, but at the end of the day, he's just talking about terrorism. This is white supremacy. This is the intellectual justification for terrorizing non-white people worldwide, particularly black people. He's just laying it out where it can sound really nice. And that is, in my experience, that is something that whites do all the time. But the deviance just gets covered over by a lot of highfalutin talk. They are experts at that.
Go ahead. I'll go after you.
Okay. I just wanted to concur. I have spent a great deal of time around these type of people. In fact, in my early days of the internet, I found myself on forums where college professors, people who had PhDs, white people who had PhDs, engaged in some of the most vicious racist rhetoric. And when you read their papers, the papers that these people have published, you can see that their online self or their unvarnished self kind of shines through when you read their words. And I really do appreciate some of the insight that Gus has given to us when interpreting some of the sexualized language that is strewn throughout all of these texts, because that is really at the core of what they're about. If you go on any of the extreme, some of the more extreme pages on the internet, and when you go into the kind of sexual deviant side of these things, you'll notice that it's a lot of very highfalutin style white people using all types of words. If you're on any of these sex websites, like FetLife, for instance, you'll see that these people use these terms quite explicitly, and they're extremely verbose, and that's something that they value. Like some of the most vicious white supremacists, they value extremely verbose, sexualized language, and that's something that I've observed throughout my life, and that's something that it becomes more and more clear the deeper and deeper we delve into some of these really arcane texts. I'll mute my line there.
Roz?
Yes, I think that was a brilliant observation because sex is a part of their practice of warfare, is a sexual activity. And there's many examples of that, like the people who had killed a black male and had sex on top of his body. I think they were teenagers, if I'm not mistaken. The gun itself being a phallic symbol, the brilliance of Dr. Welsing. Again, there's just many examples of that. So I agree with you emphatically. I thought that was a brilliant observation. Also, in my opinion, I just always thought that the most dangerous white people wear suits and ties. They're the most sexually deviant as far as the things that they do in secret that people don't know that they partake in would be mind-blowing simply because of the way that they function, and they're deadly in the sense that they're capable of them. They're even more psychopathic. Usually the people who are the deadliest are the ones, Cecil Rhodes, Hillary Clinton. I mean, like there's so many of them. They wear these high-end clothes and they speak in this highfalutin language, like the previous caller said, and they'll turn around and, you know, take your life in a heartbeat and not think twice about it. And the last thing I wanted to touch on was, to me, some of the Syrian people remind me of Jewish people, where like Hitler would understand that they're not white people, even though they can pass for white, and then eventually they were given honorary white status, especially in America. To me, Syrians can eventually get to that point because, to me, they have that similar look where they're considered non-white just by being from Syria proper. But physically speaking, they have been genetically diluted to the point that they actually look like white people. And I'll mute my line.
Our caller in the DMV area, did you have enough time to get your thoughts together, or did you want to wait until after the second audio segment?
Can I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. I have more, but one thing I wanted to add was the use of the word booty. There was like a passage where booty was used at least 3 times, just to add to the hypersexualized tone of the dialogue or the monologue, really. Y'all remember that part where he just says booty over and over and over again?
Absolutely. I thought the same thing.
I thought booty was not just treasure, it was definitely sexual. So absolutely, I agree emphatically, and a brilliant observation.
Well, I was like, I kind of laughed a little bit when I heard that. But anyway, I just wanted to mention that one too, that I picked up on booty. But I'll comment after this.
And it speaks a lot to their homosexual culture. Booty. Oh, goodness. Wow. Dr. Welsing again.
The passage that stood out in particular, where he says, with France, there is no need for haste. She has already realized why we withheld troops, which alone might have driven the invader from her soil. Her fingers are clutching more tightly around her oriental booty, yet she knows it is ours for the taking. But there is no need of haste. The world condemns the paltry thief. Only the glorious conqueror wins the plaudits and approval of mankind. Now, that passage is a quote. That is not Stoddard. This is a quote of a non-white writer talking about trying to take the U.S. Territory in North America, citing the imperial leanings of Japan. But just the fact that he includes it, and that's not the only passage in the book where booty is written in this sense. So it's regular. This is not the only time, but that passage in particular stood out. Great commentary. I did, the last thing I'll get in before we get to the second audio, I also thought the portion where he says the Meccan Hajj, where tens of thousands of picked zealots gather every year from every quarter of the Muslim world, is really an annual pan-Islamic conference to organize their propaganda. That was, again, one of those where I just thought, wow, staggering hyperbole. But again, what I said, what's at least to me seeming like one of the main themes of the book, is that any sense, any notion that non-white people could be organizing, I don't get the sense that this is a threat because of their religious practice, but it's non-white people that could be organizing, codifying their behavior in a constructive manner. That is the threat. We do not want to see non-white people organizing and doing anything to work against our white domination worldwide. We'll go ahead and get to the second audio segment. We'll get caller in Alabama's question before we wrap,
If you have other comments you did not get in, just make a note. We'll be sure to include your commentary before we wrap things up. So we're picking up. We're in Chapter 3, Midpoint. Lothrop Stoddard, The Rising Tide of Color Against White World Supremacy, Context of White Supremacy, audio segment number 2.
On their part, the Senussi are equally careful to avoid a downright breach with the European powers. Their long-headed, cautious policy is truly astonishing. For more than a half a century, the Order has been a great force, yet it has never risked the supreme adventure. In all the numerous fanatic risings against Europeans which have occurred in various parts of Africa, local Senussi have undoubtedly taken part, but the Order has never officially entered the lists. These Fabian tactics as regards open warfare do not mean that the Senussi are idle. Far from it. On the contrary, they are ceaselessly at work with the spiritual arms of teaching, discipline, and conversion. The Senussi program is the welding, first of Muslim Africa, and later of the whole Muslim world, into the revived Imamat of Islam's early days, into a great theocracy embracing all true believers. In other words, pan-Islamism. But they believe that the political liberation of Islam from Christian domination must be preceded by profound spiritual regeneration, thereby engendering the moral forces necessary both for the war of liberation and for the fruitful reconstruction which should follow thereafter. This is the secret of the Order's extraordinary self-restraint. This is the reason why, year after year, and decade after decade, the Senussi advance slowly, calmly, coldly, gathering great latent power but avoiding the temptation to expend it one instant before the proper time. Meanwhile, they are covering Africa with their lodges and schools, disciplining the people to the voice of their makadims and wakils, and converting millions of pagan Negroes to the faith of Islam. And what is true of the Senussi holds equally for the other wise leaders who guide the pan-Islamic movement. They know both Europe's strength and their own weakness. They know the peril of premature action. Feeling that time is on their side, they are content to await the hour when internal regeneration and external pressure shall have filled to overflowing the cup of wrath. This is why Islam has offered only local resistance to the unparalleled white aggressions of the last 20 years. This is the main reason why there was no real holy war in 1914. But the materials for a holy war have long been piling high, as a retrospective glance will show. Europe's conquest of Africa and Central Asia toward the close of the last century and the subsequent Anglo-French agreement mutually appropriating Egypt and Morocco evoked murmurs of impotent fury from the Muslim world. Under such circumstances, the Russo-Japanese War of 1904 sent a feverish tremor throughout Islam. The Japanese might be idolaters, but the traditional Muslim loathing of idolaters as beings much lower than Christians and Jews, recognized by Muhammad as peoples of the book, was quite effaced by the burning sense of subjugation to the Christian yoke. Accordingly, the Japanese were hailed as heroes throughout Islam. Here we see again that the tendency toward an understanding between Asiatic and African races and creeds, in other words, a pan-colored alliance against white domination, which has been so patent in recent years. The way in which Islamic peoples begin looking to Japan is revealed by this editorial in a Persian newspaper, written in the year 1906. Quote, "Desirous of becoming as powerful as Japan, and of safeguarding its national independence, Persia should make common cause with it. An alliance becomes necessary. There should be a Japanese ambassador at Tehran. Japanese instructors should be chosen to reorganize the army. Commercial relations should also be developed." End quote. Indeed, some pious Muslims hoped to bring this heroic people within the Islamic fold. Shortly after the Russo-Japanese War, a Chinese Mohammedan sheikh wrote, quote, "If Japan thinks of becoming someday a very great power and making Asia the dominator of the other continents, it will be only by adopting the blessed religion of Islam." End quote. And Al-Mawayad, an Egyptian nationalist journal, remarked, quote, "England, with her 60 million Indian Muslims, dreads this conversion. With a Mohammedan Japan, Muslim policy would change entirely." End quote. As a matter of fact, Mohammedan missionaries actually went to Japan, where they were smilingly received. Of course, the Japanese had not the faintest intention of turning Muslims, but these spontaneous approaches from the brown world were quite in line with their ambitious plans, which, as the reader will remember, were just then taking concrete shape. However, it soon became plain that Japan had no present intention of going so far afield as Western Asia, and Islam presently had to mourn fresh losses at Christian hands. In 1911 came Italy's barefaced raid on Turkey's African dependency of Tripoli. So bitter was the anger in all Mohammedan lands at this unprovoked aggression that many European observers became seriously alarmed. Quote, "Why has Italy found defenseless Tripoli such a hornet's nest?" End quote. Queried Gabriel Hanatal, a former French minister of foreign affairs. Quote, "It is because she has to do not merely with Turkey, but with Islam as well. Italy has set the ball rolling. So much the worse for her and for us all." End quote. But the Tripoli expedition was only the beginning of the Christian assault, for next year came the Balkan War, which sheared away Turkey's European holdings to the walls of Constantinople and left her crippled and discredited. At these disasters, a cry of wrathful anguish swept the world of Islam from end to end. Here is how a leading Indian Muslim interpreted the Balkan conflict. Quote, "The King of Greece orders a new crusade. From the London chancelleries rise calls to Christian fanaticism, and St. Petersburg already speaks of the planting of the cross on the dome of St. Sophia. Today they speak thus. Tomorrow they will thus speak of Jerusalem and the Mosque of Omar. Brothers, be ye of one mind, that it is the duty of every true believer to hasten beneath the Khalifa's banner, and to sacrifice his life for the safety of the faith." Quote, "I appeal to the present government to change its anti-Turkish attitude before the fury of millions of Muslim fellow subjects is kindled to a blaze and brings disaster." End quote. Still more significant were the appeals made by the Indian Muslims to their Brahmin fellow countrymen, the traditionally despised idolaters. These appeals betokened a veritable revolution in outlook, as can be gauged from the text of one of them, significantly entitled The Message of the East. Quote, "Spirit of the East," end quote, reads this noteworthy document. Quote, "Arise and repel the swelling flood of Western aggression. Children of Hindustan, aid us with your wisdom, culture, and wealth. Lend us your power, the birthright and heritage of the Hindu. Let the spirit powers hidden in the Himalayan mountain peaks arise. Let prayers to the God of battles float upward. Prayers that right may triumph over might, and call to your myriad gods to annihilate the armies of the foe." End quote. In China, also the same fraternizing spirit was visible. During the Republican Revolution, the Chinese Mohammedans, instead of holding jealously aloof, cooperated wholeheartedly with their Buddhist and Confucian fellow citizens, and Dr. Sun Yat-sen, the Republican leader, announced gratefully, quote, "The Chinese will never forget the assistance which their Muslim compatriots have rendered in the interest of order and liberty." End quote. The Great War thus found Islam deeply stirred against European oppression, keenly conscious of its own solidarity, and frankly reaching out for colored allies in the projected struggle against white domination. Under these circumstances, it may at first sight appear strange that no general Islamic explosion occurred when Turkey entered the lists at the close of 1914, and the Sultan Khalifa issued a formal summons to the Holy War. Of course, this summons was not the flat failure which Allied reports led the West to believe at the time. As a matter of fact, there was trouble in practically every Mohammedan land under Allied control. To name only a few of many instances, Egypt broke into a tumult smothered only by overwhelming British reinforcements. Tripoli burst into a flame of insurrection that drove the Italians headlong to the coast. Persia was prevented from joining Turkey only by prompt Russian intervention, and the Indian Northwest frontier was the scene of fighting that required the presence of 250,000 Anglo-Indian troops. The British government has officially admitted that during 1915, the Allies' Asiatic and African possessions stood within a hand's breadth of a cataclysmic insurrection. That insurrection would certainly have taken place if Islam's leaders had everywhere spoken the fateful word. But the word was not spoken. Instead, influential Muslims outside of Turkey generally condemned the latter's action and did all in their power to calm the passions of the fanatic multitude. The attitude of these leaders does credit to their disconcertment. They recognized that this was neither the time nor the occasion for a decisive struggle with the West. They were not yet materially prepared, and they had not perfected their understandings either among themselves or with their prospective non-Muslim allies. Above all, the moral urge was lacking. They knew that athwart the Khalifa's writ was stenciled "Made in Germany." They knew that the Young Turk clique which had engineered the coup was made up of Europeanized renegades, many of them not even nominal Muslims, but atheistic Jews. Far-sighted Muslims had no intention of pulling Germany's chestnuts out of the fire, nor did they wish to further Prussian schemes of world dominion, which for themselves would have meant a mere change of masters. Far better to let the white world fight out its desperate feud, weaken itself, and reveal fully its future intentions. Meanwhile, Islam could bide its time, grow in strength, and await the morrow. The Versailles Peace Conference was just such a revelation of European intentions as the pan-Islamic leaders had been awaiting in order to perfect their programs and enlist the moral solidarity of their peoples. At Versailles, the European powers showed unequivocally that they had no intention of relaxing their hold upon the Near and Middle East. By a number of secret treaties negotiated during the war, the Ottoman Empire had been virtually partitioned between the victorious allies, and these secret treaties formed the basis of the Versailles settlement. Furthermore, Egypt had been declared a British protectorate at the very beginning of the European struggle, while the Versailles Conference had scarcely adjourned before England announced an agreement with Persia, which made that country another British protectorate, in fact, if not in name. The upshot was, as already stated, that the Near and Middle East were subjected to European political domination as never before. But there was another side to the shield. During the war years, the Allied statesmen had officially proclaimed times without number that the war was being fought to establish a new world order based on such principles as the rights of small nations and the liberty of all peoples. These pronouncements had been treasured and memorized throughout the East. When, therefore, the East saw a peace settlement based not upon these high professions, but upon the imperialistic secret treaties, it was fired with a moral indignation and sense of outraged justice never known before. A tide of impassioned determination began rising, which had already set the entire East in tumultuous ferment, and which seems merely the premonitory groundswell of a greater storm. Many European students of Eastern affairs are gravely alarmed at the prospect. Here, for example, is the judgment of Leone Caetani, Duke of Sermoneta, an Italian authority on Oriental and Mohammedan questions. Speaking in the spring of 1919 on the war's effect on the East, he said, quote, "The convulsion has shaken Islamic and Oriental civilization to its foundations. The entire Oriental world, from China to the Mediterranean, is in ferment. Everywhere, the hidden fire of anti-European hatred is burning. Riots in Morocco, risings in Algiers, discontent in Tripoli, so-called nationalist attempts in Egypt, Arabia, and Libya are all different manifestations of the same deep sentiment, and have as their object the rebellion of the Oriental world against European civilization." End quote. The state of affairs in Egypt is a typical illustration of what has been going on in the East ever since the close of the late war. Egypt was occupied by England in 1882, and British rule has conferred immense material benefits, raising the country from anarchic bankruptcy to ordered prosperity. Yet, British rule was never really popular, and as the years passed, a nationalist movement steadily grew in strength, having for its slogan the phrase, "Egypt for the Egyptians," and demanding Britain's complete evacuation of the country. This demand Great Britain refused even to consider. Practically all Englishmen are agreed that Egypt, with the Suez Canal, is the vital link between the eastern and western halves of the British Empire, and they therefore consider the permanent occupation of Egypt an absolute necessity. There is thus a clear deadlock between British imperial and Egyptian national convictions. Some years before the war, Egypt became so unruly that England was obliged to abandon all thoughts of conciliation and initiated a regime of frank repression enforced by Lord Kitchener's heavy hand. The European War and Turkey's adhesion to the Teutonic powers caused fresh outbreaks in Egypt, but these were quickly repressed, and England took advantage of Ottoman belligerency to abolish the fiction of Turkish overlordship and declare Egypt a protectorate of the British Empire. During the war, Egypt, flooded with British troops, remained quiet, but the end of the war gave the signal for an unparalleled outburst of nationalist activity. Basing their claims on such doctrines as the rights of small nations and the self-determination of peoples, the nationalists demanded immediate independence and attempted to get Egypt's case before the Versailles Peace Conference. In defiance of English prohibitions, they even held a popular plebiscite, which upheld their claims. When the British authorities answered this defiance by arresting nationalist leaders, Egypt flamed into rebellion from end to end. Everywhere it was the same story. Railways and telegraph lines were systematically cut. Trains were stalled and looted. Isolated British officers and soldiers were murdered. In Cairo alone, thousands of houses were sacked by the mob. Soon, the danger was rendered more acute by the eruption out of the desert of swarms of Bedouin Arabs bent on plunder. For a few days, Egypt trembled on the verge of anarchy, and the British government admitted in Parliament that all Egypt was in a state of insurrection. The British authorities, however, met the crisis with vigor and determination. The number of British troops in Egypt was very large. Trusty black regiments were hurried up from the Sudan, and the well-disciplined Egyptian native police generally obeyed orders. The result was that after several weeks of sharp fighting lasting through the spring of 1919, Egypt was again gotten under control. The outlook for the future is, however, ominous in the extreme. Order is indeed restored, but only the presence of massed British and Sudanese black troops guarantees that order will be maintained. Even under the present regime of stern martial law, hardly a month passes without fresh rioting and heavy loss of life. Egypt appears nationalist to the core. Its spokesmen swear they will accept nothing short of independence, and in the long run, Britain will realize the truth of that pithy saying, quote, "You can do everything with bayonets except sit on them." End quote. India is likewise in a state of profound unrest. The vast peninsula has been controlled by England for almost two centuries, yet here again, the last two decades have witnessed a rapidly increasing movement against British rule. This movement was at first confined to the upper-class Hindus, the great Mohammedan element preserving its traditional loyalty to the British Raj, which it considered a protection against the Brahmanistic Hindu majority. But, as already seen, the pan-Islamic leaven presently reached the Indian Muslims. European aggressions on Islam stirred their resentment, and at length Muslim and Hindu adjourned their ancient feud in their new solidarity against European tutelage. The Great War provoked relatively little sedition in India. Groups of Hindu extremists, to be sure, hatched terroristic plots and welcomed German aid, but India, as a whole, backed England and helped win the war with both money and men. At the same time, Indians gave notice that they expected their loyalty to be rewarded, and at the close of the war, various memorials were drawn up calling for drastic modifications of the existing governmental regime. India is today governed by an English civil service whose fairness, honesty, and general efficiency no informed person can seriously impugn. But this no longer contents Indian aspirations. India desires not merely good government, but self-government. The ultimate goal of all Indian reformers is emancipation from European tutelage, though they differ among themselves as to how and when this emancipation is to be attained. The most conservative would be contentment with self-government under British guidance. The middle group asks for the full status of a dominion of the British Empire, like Canada and Australia, while the radicals demand complete independence. Even the most conservative of these demands would, however, involve great changes of system and a diminution of British control. Such demands arouse in England mistrust and apprehension. Englishmen point out that India is not a nation, but a congeries of diverse peoples spiritually sundered by barriers of blood, language, culture, and religion. And they conclude that, if England's control were really relaxed, India would get out of hand and drift toward anarchy. As for Indian independence, the average Englishman cannot abide the thought, holding it fatal for both the British Empire and for India itself. The result has been that England has failed to meet Indian demands, and this in turn has aroused an acute recrudescence of dissatisfaction and unrest. The British government has countered with coercive legislation like the Rowlatt Acts and has sternly repressed rioting and terrorism. British authority is still supreme in India, but it is an authority resting more and more upon force. In fact, some Englishmen have long considered British rule in India, despite its imposing appearance, a decidedly fragile affair. Many years ago, Meredith Townsend, who certainly knew India well, wrote, quote, "The English think they will rule India for many centuries, or forever. I do not think so, holding rather the older belief that the empire which came in a day will disappear in a night. Above all this inconceivable mass of humanity, governing all, protecting all, taxing all, rises what we call here the empire, a corporation of less than 1,500 men, partly chosen by examination, partly by co-optation, who are set to govern, and who protect themselves in governing by finding pay for a minute white garrison of 65,000 men, one-fifth of the Roman legions, though the masses to be controlled are double the subjects of Rome. That corporation and that garrison constitute the Indian Empire. There is nothing else. Banish those 1,500 men in black, defeat that slender garrison in red, and the empire has ended. The structure disappears, and brown India emerges, unchanged and unchangeable. To support the official world and its garrison, both, recollect, smaller than those of Belgium, there is, except Indian opinion, absolutely nothing. Not only is there no white race in India, not only is there no white colony, but there is no white man who proposes to remain. There are no white servants, not even grooms, no white policemen, no white postmen, no white anything. If the brown men struck for a week, the empire would collapse like a house of cards, and every ruling man would be a starving prisoner in his own house. He could not move or feed himself or get water." End quote. These words aptly illustrate the truth stated at the beginning of this book, that the basic factor in human affairs is not politics, but race, and that the most imposing political phenomena of themselves mean nothing. And that is just the fatal weakness underlying the white man's present political domination over the brown world. Throughout that entire world, there is no settled white population, save in the French colonies of Algeria and Tunis along the Mediterranean seaboard, where whites form perhaps one-sixth of the total. Elsewhere, from Morocco to the Dutch Indies, there is, in the racial sense, as Townsend well says, no white anything. And if white rule vanished tomorrow, it would not leave a human trace behind. White rule is therefore purely political, based on prescription, prestige, and lack of effective opposition. These are indeed fragile foundations. Let the brown world once make up its mind that the white man must go, and he will go, for his position will have become simply impossible. It's not solely a question of a holy war. Mere passive resistance, if genuine and general, would shake white rule to its foundations. And it is precisely the determination to get rid of white rule which seems to be spreading like wildfire over the brown world today. The unrest which I have described in Egypt and India merely typify what is going on in Morocco, Central Asia, the Dutch Indies, the Philippines, and every other portion of the brown world whose inhabitants are above the grade of savages. Another factor favoring the prospects of brown emancipation is the lack of sustained resistance, which the white world would probably offer. For the white world's interests in these regions, though great, are not fundamental. That is to say, racial. However grievously they might suffer politically and economically, racially, the white peoples would lose almost nothing. Here again, we see the basic importance of race in human affairs. Contrast, for example, England's attitude toward an insurgent India with France's attitude toward an insurgent North Africa. England, with nothing racial at stake, would hesitate before a reconquest of India involving millions of soldiers and billions of treasure. France, on the other hand, with nearly a million Europeans in her North African possessions, half of those full-blooded Frenchmen, might risk her last franc and her last poilu rather than see these blood brothers slaughtered and enslaved. Assuming, then, what today seems probable, that white political control over the brown world is destined to be sensibly curtailed, if not generally eliminated, what are the larger racial implications? Above all, will the browns tend to impinge on white race areas as the yellows show signs of doing? Probably no, at least not to any great extent. In the first place, the brown world has within its present confines plenty of room for potential race expansion. Outside India, Egypt, Java, and a few lesser spots, there is scarcely a brown land where natural improvements such as irrigation would not open up extensive settlement areas. Mesopotamia alone, now almost uninhabited, might support a vast population, while Persia could nourish several times its present inhabitants. India, to be sure, is almost as congested as China, and the specter of the Indian coolie has lately alarmed white lands like Canada and South Africa almost as much as the Chinese coolie has done. But an independent India would fall under the same political blight as the rest of the brown world, the blight of internecine dissensions and wars. The brown world's present growing solidarity is not a positive but a negative phenomenon. It is an alliance against a common foe of traditional enemies who, once the bond was loosed in victory, would inevitably quarrel among themselves. Turk would fly at Arab and Turkoman at Persian, as of yore, while India would become a welter of contending Hindus, Muslims, Sikhs, Gurkhas, and heaven knows what, until perchance disciplined anew by the pressure of a yellow peril. In Western Asia, it is possible that the spiritual and cultural bonds of Islam might temper these struggles. But Western Asia is precisely that part of the brown world where population pressure is absent. India, the overpeopled brown land, would undergo such a cycle of strife as would devour its human surplus and render distant aggressions impossible. A potential brown menace to white race areas would, indeed, arise in case of a brown-yellow alliance against the white peoples. But such an alliance could occur only in the first stages of a pan-colored war of liberation, while the pressure of white world predominance was still keenly felt, and before the divisive tendencies within the brown world had begun to take effect. Short of such an alliance, wherein the browns would abet the yellows' aggressive racial objectives in return for yellow support of their own essentially defensive political ends, the brown world's emancipation from white domination would apparently not result in more than local pressures on white race areas. It would, however, affect another sphere of white political control, Black Africa. The emancipation of brown, Islamic North Africa would inevitably send a sympathetic thrill through every portion of the Dark Continent and would stir both Mohammedan and pagan Negroes against white rule. Islam is, in fact, the intimate link between the brown and black worlds, but this subject, with its momentous implications, will be discussed in the next chapter.
Discussed in the next chapter, next week. Context of white supremacy, that will do it. We'll pick up next week. We'll be on the beginning of chapter 4. Number again is 641-715-3640. The code is 564-943-#. Press star 6 if you would like to participate.
We have a smidge less than 30 minutes left, so please do not wait till the last minute if you have commentary you would like to share. Everybody is with us who dialed in with a hand up. The caller at 5771, last four digits. Did you have commentaries?
Yes, can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Just a couple of things. I remember last week when we were talking about the book and the time frame that it was in, I was saying one of the events that probably prompted the necessary writing in the book was, you know, the 1920s was the height of the Garvey movement. So while we're reading it, I see something that says something similar to one of the Garveyite phrases, Egypt for the Egyptians. And I'm like, where have you heard that from in another, you know, another deviation, Africa for the Africans? So it to me sounds like a signal that Lopert Stoddard is saying, you know, if we give Africa to the Africans, then the Egyptians are going to be getting, you know, everybody's going to be wanting, you know, the lands that the white man has colonized already for themselves. So I think that's kind of like a subtle warning that he's giving in this book to his white people, white brethren and sisters and white supremacy, that this is going to be an issue and this is going to be a problem. So there was something else I wanted to say that caught my attention. If I come up with it, I'll chime back in. But for now, that's about it.
Grand. Great observation. All the other folks who dialed in who were with us before, 1842, Roz, Carlin, Alabama, Ken Steele, you should be with us. Feel free if you have commentary.
Can I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. So one of the things that I've been trying to kind of not get too lost all in exactly what this person is saying, but kind of like the forest a little bit. And I realize we say it all the time that they're masters in the art of deception. But I also like kind of reworded it to say like psychic manipulation, because one of the things it seems that is, and I'll try my hardest to get this across clear. If I say something first, that I make my voice the only voice that's heard, and I repeat it over and over and over, I make it absolute truth. And it seems as though that is what occurs all the time and what occurred in the past when talking about like rewriting history or saying what is so. Because race, you know, they'll talk about how race now was not always, or race in the past was not always an issue until white people made it an issue. But so also keeping that in mind. And then when there was a quote, and I'm paraphrasing, when non-white people make up their mind that whites got to go, whites are going to go. So then if they know that, then they know that the like primary, most effective form of warfare has to be psychic, no matter what, not even just the manipulation or deception, like to get you to sign treaties and lands away and stuff like that, but to really mess non-white people's mind up all the way through and through, because if we ever got clear, like if we ever woke up, or I don't even, if we ever got clarity, if our minds got clear long enough, we would all eventually come to a very similar resolve around the world. You know, maybe there are cliques and stuff like that in certain places who manage to make white friends and all that kind of stuff. But like if the globe and at one time non-white people just like, you know, we'd be like, this got to end. These people got to go. Too much has been done. They keep doing stuff. It's just not going to work. Like just at a basic level. But then I also thought about something that was interesting to invoke or respect Dr. Welsing's work. And she always used the analogy of chess. So if the whiteboard moves, or the white piece moves first, and so that they have this fear, like I also thought when they stepped off of the peninsula, went around the world, realized that the world was brown. I mean, there were many choices. It didn't have to be white domination. That didn't have to be the only thing that they could have done. But there was a fear that everyone, and someone else mentioned it, that the rest of the world
would respond to them the way that they chose to respond to the rest of the world. Because it's quite possible if they didn't want to disappear, they could actually use their psychic manipulation and all that on each other and elevate, you know, the white man elevate the white woman and the white woman elevate the white man and make it so that they found nobody else valuable enough to engage in sexual activity and have a mixed race population. They could just say, well, we want to be here in perpetuity, so let's only have sex with each other. But they didn't make that choice. So off of that, if the chessboard and the white piece makes the move to go and dominate and subjugate the rest of the world. And so, which is really interesting, because just by knowing that, if I'm just thinking about how I was viewing it, if that's their move based off of fear, and they've already said if non-white people ever realize that we just don't want them here anymore, we could just not have them anymore. He also doesn't mention weapons. Like, he uses words like force and stuff, but he never really talks about the reason that non-white people have been ineffective at getting rid of them is because they went and amassed weapons and kept everybody else from having weapons. And just, you know, that makes a really big difference when you have, you know, cannons and people don't, or you have automatic weapons and other people don't. So it's not so much that we just didn't have our mind right to do it. It's weapons really, really kind of kept us from doing it. But anyway, they back to the chessboard. If they make that move, not if, but since they made that move first, off of fear, thinking, well, we got to subjugate and dominate everybody else, because if we don't, they're going to turn around and do it to us and we're going to be gone. Then that was their move. So then our move would be like, if we understood that, it kind of checkmates them anyway. Because they already know the thing that we need to know. Am I being clear? I don't know if I am. But one of the things that came across about white psychology is a constant fear of loss. Like, it's just in everything that they talk about, everything that they do, they just fear losing anything and everything that they think they have ever had. And I'll mute myself on that.
Right on. Other folks was that you?
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Yes, sir. Yes, greetings. I think the previous caller made some really, really incredibly brilliant observations. And she's absolutely right. He uses a lot of verbiage, but the buckets and buckets of words. But essentially, he is letting them know in so many words that, like she said, if we were to just, you know, snap out of the spell that we're under, the white supremacist spell, and we all came to the same consensus, the same answer, there would really be nothing they could do about it. It'll get really bad, but there's nothing they could do about it. There's not enough of them unless they do something really crazy, which I believe, like Michael Bradley said, if they can't have the planet, they are willing to destroy the entire planet and every living thing on it. So that's something we have to think about. But I think that's a heavy warning that he's giving. On page 40, where I talked about the fact that he had given the impression that the traditional Muslim priesthood had some power that the, you know, the white people had to be wary of. On the following paragraph, he writes, on their part, the Senussi are equally careful to avoid a downright breach with the European powers. Their long-headed, cautious policy is truly astonishing. For more than half a century, the order has been a great force, yet it has never risked the supreme adventure. That's what they call the war with white supremacists, the supreme adventure. In all the numerous fanatic risings against Europeans, which have occurred in various parts of Africa, the local Senussi have undoubtedly taken part, but the order has never officially entered the lists. And basically what he's saying is they know who's really in power, and that's why he said it was their long-headed cautious policy is truly astonishing, meaning their ability to kowtow to white supremacy is truly astonishing. That's all that's saying right there. He's just speaking in code. And I find the term Senussi very interesting because there's a priest named Credo Mutwa from South Africa, and he's actually known as what they call a high Senussi, which is a high priest from South Africa. So I want to do some research to see if there's any connection there, because I find it's spelled differently, though, but it's pronounced exactly the same way. Later in the text, he writes, the English point out that India is not a nation, but
a country of diverse people spiritually sundered by barriers of blood, language, culture, and religion. And they conclude that if England's control were really relaxed, India would get out of hand and drift towards anarchy. And when he was going through each area that Britain had control of, and then he named a bunch of places at the end of the treatise he was giving, all he's saying is exactly what I've always said, that white people are anthropomorphic cancer. Wherever they go, they bring death and destruction. And the kind of wars they create amongst non-white people is legendary. When you look at the situation in India, where they named all those groups, the Sikhs, the Gurkhas, the Hindus, the Muslims, what they did there was they basically did there what they did in Rwanda with the Hutu and the Tutsi. They took the Muslim minority and put them against the Hindu majority. And when they left, the problems were so bad that they had to have their own separate country that we now know as Pakistan. And both of them now have nukes, and they're ready to blow each other to smithereens based on the wars that were created by white people. And wherever they go, that's what they create. It's just sheer anarchy. They are death on two legs. And like Gus always says, don't sleep on them and don't sleep with them. And I think this text really brings this portion of the text, as grandiose and propagandized as it is. It really brings home the fact that they are just destruction on two legs. And it's really gives a lot of pause for thought. And again, Dr. Wilson's brilliance shines in just what we're garnering from the text. Thank you.
Right on. Other folks we have not heard from have commentary. Let's not lollygag today. If you have, we have about 15 minutes left. If you have comments you want to get in, let's get them in now.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Just quickly, you know, I noticed, and, you know, I've noticed this all along, non-white, non-black people use the term Western or Westerner in regards to their definition of white people or white supremacy. You know, it's kind of like a more geographical term. I just kind of noticed that in this text as well, when he prints the quotes of some of the people, I forgot who it is, but, you know, some of the non-white people that he prints the quotes to, they use the term Westerner or Western, you know, Western people.
Right. That's still kind of a common theme, I think, even because this is 1920 vernacular, like Chinwizu, who's a guest on our program, on his really constructive work, he authored The West and the Rest of Us. You could replace West with whites, racists, and it would still be accurate. But yeah, I think that's still pretty common. I think white is getting more accurate, one, because they say that they are white, and two, because west of what? It's not very, in my view, it's not very specific, like west of what exactly? Like
Yeah, that's what I was thinking of.
Mm-hmm. Appreciate that. Anybody else have comments? Right on.
Yes, can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, man, I just, you know, this book is kind of mind-blowing because it kind of put me into the, you know, because it made me look at all these people, you know, that they mind operate just like that. And like the lady was saying earlier, you know, when you think about the Chessy, they operate in a sneaky, deceptive type of way. You see what I'm saying? And I know he said something. You know, one thing I caught on about the book where he say that he said somewhere was a place for savages, a place where the Indians was at, or something like that. It was a place for savages without them, right? And I'm like, well, golly, if it's a place for savages, then what made these people want to go over there and just you know, terrorize the people that take the land? But anyhow, you know, like I was saying, man, you know, when it comes to playing chess, you know, so you know, people know how they play in the game. Like she say, you know, they made the first move, you know. But yeah, it's funny, man, because I think
I'm really starting to think we're going to win. You know what I mean? I'm starting to think that, you know, I mean, I really kind of feel like that, but because they really ain't that smart. This guy right here, you know, he got a strong vocabulary, but, you know, and that's what I feel about all these people, man. Like, they, you know, they got a good speech, but nothing that they produce or nothing, none of these systems that they got in place, none of it is productive, and it even hurt white people themselves. You know what I mean? Even though everything is supposed to be constructed to destroy us, it even affect them. You know, now they birth rates in decline, and you know, but anyhow, let me, you know, I don't want to get off the book, but I'm glad that you on this book, man, because I think this book right here will put you right into perspective of how you supposed to look at every single one of these people when you come in contact with them, you know, and don't never let them deceive you into thinking otherwise. You move my line. Thank you.
Hello? Or can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Yes. One thing, an observation that the author made that I thought was very accurate was that when he mentioned that white people would have no choice but to leave if they are not wanted in an area. And that's one thing that I've noticed throughout my life is that that's a code that suspected white supremacists follow. Anywhere where they are explicitly not wanted by the majority or the controlling or the dominant parties in an area, they vacate. They will not. You won't see unwelcome white people going to places where they're not wanted. For example, I don't think you will see, or rather they won't persist in those places without a plan of action. I don't think, for instance, you saw too many examples of white people behaving the same way that non-white people have been behaving at these so-called Trump rallies. You wouldn't see a suspected white supremacist at anything that would be resembling an environment of a Trump rally that was a non-white environment. They just simply don't go there, and they don't persist. Everywhere where white supremacists dominate, I believe that a sizable chunk of the non-white population desires them to be there. And I think that this is a result of an effective psychological warfare that they've conducted against non-white people. And I think that might be one of the advantages that white supremacists have with the code that they operate under. They just simply do not persist in places where they're not wanted. Again, I've seen examples of non-white people seeking to be in environments where they are not wanted. For example, the non-white person that was at the Trump rally, where he was.
Does this have to relate to the book? It seems like we've deviated.
Oh, no, I'm not deviating. I'm just saying they just don't. I'm just saying, hey, they're white people do not persist in areas or environments where they are not wanted by the non-white majority or the controlling parties of a non-white organization. They just don't go. If you're not, again, there are people, I see this kind of dynamic play out in so-called interracial relationships, where oftentimes we've noticed on this show that the non-white person clearly wants to be with that white person and will make exceptions to keep that white person
Mr.
around.
Steele, and does this have to do with the book?
I'm just saying that it's just it's an insight that the author made that, hey, when white people are not wanted in an area, they will leave or they will acquiesce and they will go.
Okay.
at least just using logic, that is not accurate in my observation. Israel, South Africa, these are geographic locations where there seem to be a substantial number of non-white people who vocally announce that they do not want individuals classified as white in these particular regions. Israel, South Africa, and it seems like there's still a significant population of whites in these regions, and they seem to have a substantial amount of power, and there seems to be no indication that they're leaving by, you know, 2017, 2020, 2050. I think Guantanamo Bay might be another area where whites are occupying territory. Non-white people vocally, a sizable number of them announced that they would prefer that whites not be in that area, and they're still there. I think there are some other locations I could name as well, but at least just using logic, it seems to be that whites frequently flex pretty hard and demonstrate that they'll go wherever they want, regardless of how non-white people feel about it. That could be an error.
And now I would challenge that by saying, if you examine the non-white people in South Africa, the ones that I've interacted with, they have made, they make concessions about the state of the
Are you
the
saying that there are no locations on the planet where white people are present, where a sizable population of non-white people say, we do not want you here, and the whites stay there anyway?
Not the ones that control the cities that dominate these areas.
Okay, I'm going to pause there just because this is off the book, but some of this just comes down to the fundamentals of what we mean when we say white supremacy. Does white supremacy exist, and what does that mean? But I do contend what I said before, just using counter-racist logic, that is not accurate there. To my understanding, and just according to evidence, there are many, many locations throughout the world where white people they are present, non-white people broadcast that they do not want them there, and the whites are still there. And I think you even included in your response a caveat, without a plan. And I think you see that demonstrated all the time. Getting back to the text, some of the things that I thought were significant from the portion of the text this week. He says, here we see again the tendency toward an understanding between Asiatic and Pan-African races and creeds. In other words, a pan-colored alliance against white domination, which has been so patent in recent years. I think this is one of the major themes of the book, just in the first, we've only read three chapters in the introduction, this notion of some sort of non-white people working together. I think that's so important, particularly the notion about black self-respect and non-white people not being in conflict with each other. So, so important. If non-white people can just do that, that is a serious problem. Whites really need us to be in conflict with other non-white people. The next portion, let's see. He's quoting a non-white writer. He says, these appeals betokened a veritable revolution in outlook, as can be gauged from the text of one of them, significantly entitled The Message of the East. Spirit of the East reads this noteworthy document, arise and repel the swelling flood of Western aggression. Children of Hindustan, aid us with your wisdom, culture, and wealth. Lend us your power, the birthright and heritage of the Hindu. Let the spirit powers hidden in the Himalayan mountain peaks rise. Let prayers to the god of battles float upward. Where he goes on quoting all of this and talking about some of the religious practices these are non-white people in this area of the world they're hoping to dominate as well. Let's see. Next quote, or the next passage that I highlighted. European aggression, keenly conscious of its own solidarity and frankly reaching out for coloreds in the projected struggle against white domination. I thought this was important, just keenly conscious. I know that comes up on this program all the time, and in conversations on racism in general, are whites aware of racism, white supremacy? I contend that you cannot be a white person and be ignorant about racism. It seems that he is in agreement with me that whites, they are keenly aware, keenly conscious, he says, of this aggression and their solidarity in dominating non-white people. That's, you know, I think that's a core aspect of what it means to be white. I just don't think that it's possible to exist as someone classified as white and not understand what that means by the time you are, man, definitely by five, maybe even before that. And I have talked to whites who said that they have been racist since conception. So whatever. And I could be in error. I will stop there. I will again say, if we had anybody who was able to read the debate, would have been grand to hear your commentary. If you were not, that is fine, because you will have an opportunity. It's not very long. It's like 20 pages, the debate between Stoddard and W.E.B. Du Bois. It's titled, Shall the Negro Be Encouraged to Seek Cultural Equality? And again, this is from 1929, so this is roughly a decade after the book we're reading now was published. And one other quick thing I did want to add as well, and just in terms of how books like this and a white person going out and talking and presenting these type of views, the impact that that can have. This book came out in 1920, right? 1924, you have the Immigration Act, which severely restricts non-white people being able to legally come to this area of the world. It's almost like they were deliberately saying, we do not want non-white people coming into this part of the world. That you had people like Madison Grant, who wrote the introduction to this book, who were proponents of and calling for such legislation, certainly influenced by a book like this. That's what I mean about just the influence when you have white intellects like this guy or even permanent figures of all sorts, how that impacts large numbers of white people's thought, speech, and action and produces concrete white supremacy results. Immigration Act of 1924. I thought that was important as well. We've done our 3 hours. We will be back next Friday. For folks who listen to the archives of this, if you have commentary you would like to share, drop an email, untiljustice@gmail.com. I think we will be on this book for at least 3 weeks, maybe even longer than that, so it should be a while. We should have like at least approximately a month to be on this book. So if you are catching up in the archives, you have commentary, we can include it as we go. If you read the debate, certainly chime in, because it is interesting. I read it, and if you download the copy that I posted on my Facebook page, I have noted particular portions that I thought were significant, so you can check those out and add your own as we go through. But that commentary on that would be welcome anytime as we continue with the text. We'll be here tomorrow, compensatory call-in, 9 p.m. Eastern, 8 p.m. Central, 6 p.m. Pacific, compensatory call-in. We'll catch up news observations from the past 7 days, last weekend before the presidential election. Thank goodness. Pam will be with us next week. It will be day after the election, so next Wednesday. Pam will be with us always. A hoot catching up with her. We'll get her thoughts on how everything concludes. Thanks, everyone, for tuning in. I hope it was a constructive investment of your Friday evening, and we will catch you in about 24 hours. Again, sobriety would be best under conditions of white terrorism. We really want to make sure we put ourselves in the best possible position to make outstanding decisions in the system of racism, white supremacy. You do not want to have it be the moment when you're under the influence of alcohol or whatever it happens to be, when you bump into Daniel Holdsclaw, Aaron Wilson, any other race soldier, badge or no, whites are dangerous. Our behavior should reflect that war is being waged against us constantly in all areas of people activity worldwide. We should behave in a manner that reflects that, and I think sobriety would, you know, be a great start in that direction. That said, Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. Cal signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you're so brainwashed.
I'm a victim, your brother.
Problem. You're a victim.
I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my condition. Mm-hmm. Even my conditioning has been conditioned.